Next committee to order. I hope everyone got something to eat, so nice to see you all. We're going to hear Representative Leedersville first, and we don't yet have a quorum. Members, we've had a lot of confusion about Representative Leedersville here today amongst various staff and legislators, and we think we've got it all figured out. Representative Leader, we are going to work out the Senate file, okay? So I will move Senate File 3564 to your bill, Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee, this bill clarifies the motor fuel surcharge tax on the trunk highway bonding debt service. It makes it equal to the same, subject to the same tax assessment and enforcement and penalty and refund as the other provisions in the motor fuel taxes. The other part of the bill, it equates or brings in, modifies the increase in some of the compressed natural gas, specifically compressed natural gas, to match the proportional increase for the other types of special fuels. And it clarifies that the effective date is April 1st, 2008, which is tomorrow. And actually, that the increases are in proportion to the 2 cent gas tax for tomorrow and the 3 cent later in October. And that's the bill, Madam Chair.
Okay, are there questions from members for Representative Leader? Is there public testimony on the Representative Leader's bill?
Madam Chair.
If not, I understand there's an amendment. Is that right, Representative Leader? No.
This amendment is in here. This is requested by the Department of Revenue. That clarified that top part. The amendment clarified
okay,
the
not,
part.
Okay, Representative Leader, it's not in the packet. I think we need the pages handed out. And I'm going to cover pages. I think we asked them to copy the wrong thing. So we want to make sure we have the right thing. Okay, we're going to hold on that. We don't. Members don't have it, Representative Leader. Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Leader, on line 112, it says compressed natural gas is taxed at a rate of 1.913 as opposed to the existing, which is 1.1913. That's a pretty significant, substantial increase in the rate. Can you speak as to why there is that much of an increase?
Representative Lanning, if I may, Representative Leader, before you answer that question. Well, go ahead and answer that, but Representative Leader, I think what we probably want to have is Mr. Michael also tell folks kind of that this is really just a technical amendment from left over from the transportation bill. But Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative Lane. In the transportation bill that was passed, it was a typographical error, and this clarifies it. They had 1.19 and should have been 1.9. That's basically the error we had in our bill when we passed it originally. So this is clarifying what we passed.
Representative Lane.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Leader, refresh my memory then, what did the transportation bill change it to? What was it currently and what will it be under the new bill?
Representative Leader.
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, I'm sorry, I don't remember what initially what it was initially. But it's proportional to the increase of the 2 and 3 cent gas tax. That's proportional every time.
Representative Lanning. I think, and Representative Leader, we're having a hard time hearing you. And I know there's a lot of paper being moved around here, but Representative Lanning, I think you're getting some assistance here. Representative Lanning, if it's okay with you, I'd like to ask Mr. Michael to answer your question, but I want to clarify first. Are you trying to find out what was in the transportation bill, what the changes from current law, because this was technically left out of the transportation bill?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I understand this was correcting a typographical error here, and I was just trying to get at what the actual increase was in the transportation bill, since we're looking at a correction here in the law that was passed.
And would Mr. Michael or Ms. Dalton have that answer specifically, that Representative Lanning? Do we have the transportation fiscal analyst in the room? Maybe they know. Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Ms. Dalton just handed me...
Okay, Representative Lanning.
Ms. Dalton just handed me... a sheet indicating that the tax rate on compressed natural gas was 1.739 per 1,000 cubic feet prior to any changes, and the increase was to 1.913 per 1,000 cubic feet. So That was the increase.
Okay.
That was my question.
Okay, thank you for that, Rep. Lanning. Are there further questions?
Do we have a quorum?
We're looking for a body so we can add an amendment. I think we're one shy, so if anyone can find someone, that'd be helpful.
Madam Chair?
Rep. Leader.
This amendment is part of the bill, as I see it. It is part of House File 3868.
We're working off the current file, though, now, so it's not in there, so we're going to have to add that.
That's right.
Maybe while we wait for that final member to walk in the room so we can actually move and just put this, I could just tell members, some of the confusion that was taking place today was related to this being a Senate file as opposed to a House file. And so I thought since we have a second here, if we could just ask Mr. Michael to talk about why we think this is okay constitutionally so the committee is not concerned about it being a Senate file. Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, of course, the Constitution requires bills that are intended to raise revenue to originate in the House, and so when you have, and the courts have construed that to mean a general tax increase to raise revenue isn't required to originate in the House. And of course, this bill, if it doesn't pass, would have the effect, if the way to state it is that passing this bill will have a slight revenue effect in terms of increasing revenues, and so you could make an argument that this bill is a bill to raise revenue. I think the countervailing argument, and the one that would prevail if this were to go to court, is that courts have been very liberal in allowing bills not to originate in a House that raise revenue. In particular, it's very clear that this bill is a technical corrections bill, just to correct an error, and I think that the court would view that as the principal intent of the bill and therefore would not run afoul of the origination clause. Of course, I've also held that bills that raise revenue to fund a program, a dedicated program, also are not bills to raise revenue. So I think it's fairly safe to pass this bill as a Senate file rather than a House file without concern that it will run afoul of the origination clause.
Okay, are there questions on what Mr. Michael just said? Okay, if not, and so members, you know, my concern is a bipartisan concern of all members of the House Tax Committee is letting the Senate have a tax bill to work with. And my intention then is that because this is just a technical correction, it appears that it's okay. We just vote it out of here and have it go to the General Register and make sure that Speaker Kelleher has gotten agreement with Representative Seifert before this would come up on the floor so that people understand that that's what this is about. But this really is a technical correction to the transportation bill, and there's things happening quickly in law that if we wait until an omnibus tax bill, it's probably going to be irrelevant. So with that, I'm going to move the A1 amendment to get in the form the author would like. Is there discussion to the A1 amendment? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Further discussion to the bill? If not, all those in favor of the bill say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Leader. Appreciate it. I think we want to go next to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And members, we've had a lot of discussion already about job duties this year, yet we never actually got to hear the Office of the Legislative Auditor do their report. So we're going to do that now. We want to have questions from members on the job duty program. So welcome. And I think how this committee works best is fast presentations, lots of time for questions. So do with that what you will. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was informed of that before I got here, so I'm going to try to give you the 5-minute version of the report.
3 minutes.
Now you're making it difficult. My name is John Yunker, and I'm from the Legislative Auditor's Office. And you're getting a one-page handout to just kind of summarize some of the key things in our report on Job Z. Let me just say a few things about this program as a way of introduction. Most of the costs of this program are borne by the state. They've been about $36 million in the first 2 years of the program. Total, that's 2004 through 2006, they've doubled each year. The state costs have been about 93% over that time period of the total cost and 7% local. it's a tax expenditure program, so there's no cap on program.
Mr. Younger, I want to interrupt you. I apologize. Can you direct members to what we're looking at? Members, we have the full study in your packet, and they were sent to your office once, too. We have the major findings of the study, and we have your presentation that I think you gave at the Property Tax Committee and to the, maybe it was the State Gov Finance Committee somewhere. And then we've got your edited down version, and that's what you're working off of, right?
Madam Chair, it's the edited down version of today.
Okay, thank you.
The one-pager.
Okay.
It's a program that, as I said, is a tax expenditure program, so there's no cap on program activity. There's been no need to set priorities to make strategic decisions about what businesses should participate in the program. It's a program where local governments make the key decisions. They decide what businesses participate in the program and what the terms of their participation are, because they and the businesses write the business subsidy agreements. The Department of Employment and Economic Development has been providing very little oversight of this program. They've taken the position that JobZ is a local program, and so they really haven't looked at the business subsidy agreements to any significant degree, and they have not exercised much authority in terms of whether or not a business should participate in the program. And finally, I would just add that these JobZ subzones are plentiful and scattered and mobile. There are over 1,150 subzones throughout the state. They're not particularly targeted to economically distressed areas, and they can be moved. When a business decides they want to locate in a particular place, the subzones can be moved to where that business wants to locate. The second slide on this abbreviated version gives you our basic findings. What we did find is that the program has had mixed effectiveness. It's been successful in creating jobs in some cases. It's kept some business expansions by Minnesota businesses in the state rather than having them move out of the state. But it's also provided some unnecessary or ineffective subsidies in other cases. And we think that the program needs to be more, if it's going to be continued, it needs to be more focused and strategic in deciding which businesses can participate. We also found significant problems with the administration of the program. As I said, BEAD has provided little oversight over the program, and we found that there have been some very poorly written business subsidy agreements, and that BEAD, in monitoring the compliance with the program, monitoring compliance with business subsidy agreements, has been slow and ineffective in that effort. And finally, the report found that there really has been no targeting of this program to economically distressed areas, despite a statutory requirement to focus the zones on such areas. The program is available throughout much of greater Minnesota, and some distressed areas have not benefited much from JobZ. Let me talk a little bit about what I termed unnecessary or ineffective subsidies. DEED has been surveying since the beginning of the program, surveying businesses who participate in the program, and about 20% of those businesses said that they would have expanded in Minnesota to the same extent that they did under JobZ. They would have done it without JobZ. So basically, we've subsidized 20% of the businesses we've subsidized without any real need to do so. Another 50% said in the survey that they would have expanded to some extent in greater Minnesota without JobZ. Now, exactly how much they would have expanded here, we don't know, but there clearly is some more activity that would have occurred even without JobZ. Another problem we saw was that some JobZ businesses compete directly with other greater Minnesota businesses. JobZ participants have included a garbage hauler, an animal hospital, farm implement dealers, construction companies, electrical contractors, architects, wholesale distributors of plumbing or air conditioning parts. These are all businesses that have competitors in greater Minnesota, and if we subsidize one business, we may negatively affect others that are in the area. Finally, I think there's some reason to believe that some of these JobZ businesses would have expanded if we had offered more limited financial assistance, maybe tax increment financing or some kind of loan or guaranteed loan, some combination of benefits that are not involved in the job of the program might have been enough to get these businesses to expand in Minnesota. The fourth slide that you see on this sheet also talks about the, also mentions the problems we saw with business subsidy agreements. We found that, as I said, there have been some very poorly written agreements by cities, that some of them have very minimal requirements for creating jobs. Nearly half of the subsidy agreements created five or fewer jobs, and close to 40 of the 350 agreements required only one or no new jobs to be created. We found that about 15 of the agreements had no deadlines for creating the jobs, which means you create the jobs, but no one's telling you when you have to create them by, so theoretically you could go all the way out to the end of the program before you create them. There were also businesses that had deadlines, but there was no requirement that once having created the jobs, they had to maintain the jobs through 2015. So theoretically they could create the jobs and then reduce employment without any consequences. There are a number of other problems with the business subsidy agreement, including there's no definition in the agreement of what an employee is. Does an employee include an independent contractor or an employee of a temporary agency? Or how do you define employee? How do you calculate what a full-time equivalent employee is? And how do you calculate benefits? What benefits can be included when determining whether you've met a certain wage and benefit goal? I also mentioned that we found problems with their compliance monitoring process. When businesses have terms in the business subsidy agreement, they should be meeting. And what we found is that it has taken a year or two before DEED has detected noncompliance with those agreements. They basically have a flawed reporting form, and the combination of these things has allowed some companies to receive property tax exemptions that they should not receive. A classic example of that is a company that was non-compliant with its business subsidy agreement at the end of 2004. It was not removed from the program until the spring of 2007, and it was able to get property tax exemptions in pay 2006 and pay 2007, and it's not clear that we can recover any of those. I'm just going to highlight here a few of the recommendations, because there are over 30 recommendations in the report, half of them to the legislature. Most of the rest are to DEED, a few are to revenue. I mean, the key things that we think need to be done with this program, if you're going to maintain it, are, first of all, require prior approval of job subsidy, of business subsidy agreements by DEED before they become effective. And we think we also need a standard business subsidy agreement. DEED has had one, but local governments haven't had to follow it, and quite frankly, the standard agreement they've had has had some flaws as well. There needs to be a process of approval of these that runs through the state level. Secondly, in order for priorities to be set and for us to be more strategic, we think that there needs to be a cap. We think the legislature should place a cap on annual program activity. One way that could occur would be by capping the number of businesses that are able to enter the program in any given year. So cap the number of new entrants. Another way might be to cap the future benefits that those new entrants would receive over the life of the program. So you could say we're only going to allow entrants in a given year who would receive a total of $40 million over the life of the program. Put some sort of budgetary or a cap on the program so that DEED and local governments are forced to set priorities. We also recommend in the report that the legislature require DEED to develop and implement criteria for participation in the program. And among the things that we think Deed needs to ask of new entrants in the program before they're approved is the subsidy needed? Does it need to be JobZ, or are other is other financial assistance adequate and available? How does the project affect other greater Minnesota businesses and communities? And finally, what are the statewide benefits and costs? And are the promised jobs commensurate with the estimated cost of providing the JobZ subsidy? We also think the program needs to be targeted to economically distressed areas. And we do say in the report that the legislature should consider extending the program, but only if these other reforms are made. So, Madam Chair, that's my short version of the report, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee has.
Thank you, Mr. Younger. Questions for Mr. Is it Younger?
Yes.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Younger. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Younger, a couple questions I would have. You indicated that local governments make the key decisions with regard to the program. To what extent did your office communicate or talk with local governments about their decision-making process?
Yes, the answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, we went out and visited a number of local governments and talked with economic development directors to find out about each JobZ program that they had approved, the rationale was and what the details were of that decision. We did some of that in person, and we also did some phone interviews.
Mr. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To what extent did local governments who have been involved in the program have an opportunity to respond to your criticisms on the program and the way they handle it? Has that opportunity been given to them?
Ms. Younger.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, we shared the report with Deed. We did not share it with local governments. It would have been quite difficult to share it with everybody and still keep the report a non-public document prior to its release.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, if there are things that need to be fixed and your report points to that, it seems to me that we ought to give the people who have been making these decisions the opportunity to respond to the criticisms that the report levels. Before we go making any changes, I think we owe them the opportunity to defend themselves and respond to the criticisms that are in the report. The other thing I want to mention is this notion of capping the number. That seems to me that that assumes that somebody has a crystal ball, knowing and being able to foresee how many of these requests or proposals might surface around the state. And I don't, for the life of me, can't think of how anybody can really accurately forecast that. Do you have some suggestions as to how you can possibly determine a cap?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I don't have the crystal ball. I guess I would say that the alternative is to go on as you have, where it's basically an unlimited program. And our experience of looking at this program suggests that that's not a good idea, that there needs to be some priority setting, there needs to be some more careful examination of businesses that are asking to participate in the program. And our view here is that without a cap, that prioritization, that strategy will not be undertaken in a very serious manner.
Madam Chair,
I'm waiting.
One last question, if I may. Are you in your report essentially saying that local governments can't be trusted to make these decisions anymore?
Mr. Anker.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I would never say we can't trust our local governments, but I think we have to recognize that local governments view this from a different perspective. Local governments are interested in getting or locking in businesses in their community, and some of those expansion activities may have occurred anyway. And if we have largely state-funded program and state costs that go to helping the local government, they may not make the right decision. The right decision might be to say, well, maybe that business would move next door, also in greater Minnesota. And that might be the right decision for the state of Minnesota, even though it's not the right decision for the local government.
That's what I'm learning.
Well, Madam Chair, just to finish out, it just seems to me that the recommendations here basically says the state really ought to take over the decision making with regard to the details of this program. And that suggests to me that what the report is actually saying is that local governments really can't be fully trusted to administer this program.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. Representative Forberg.
Madam Chair, just to that point, Representative Lanning, I don't think the report says that. But I think the report, as I understand it, says there are abuses that have to be addressed.
Yeah.
And I know of one instance where some cities in my district, the application came for a job Z, and the city said no because it was competing against what they felt was businesses within the area. And it was, well, that business had a big advantage over the other businesses that it was competing against. And what they did is they went to the next city and got it. So, I mean, one city made the right decision, and I think the other city made the wrong decision. And I think what the report is saying, there has to be some consistency. Otherwise, I'm not for this program anymore. When you have that kind of decision being made, it's not a matter of trust. It's a matter of having some kind of a guarantee that we have some kind of equal kind of application of the law.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you talk to anyone, the auditor's office, talk to anyone that purports to represent the business community as to their feelings about this? The Minnesota Chamber, the Business Partnership, or anybody else that thinks they represent the business world?
Mr. Yonker.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, I don't believe we did.
And Representative Earhart, the business community is in the room, so we're taking public testimony, and if they have a thought on this, we hope they'll come up and tell us what they think about Job Z.
I'm expecting them to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Yonker? Otherwise, I think we want to hear from Deed next, and then public testimony. Mr. Yonker, I just want to tell you, I appreciate that you did that real fast. I hope you're going to stay, because I'm sure we'll have some back and forth. I just tell you my opinion so that Deed can have a chance to respond as they come to the mic. You know, I have to say that of all the legislative audits I've read in the 10 years I've been here, this one's the most scathing by far of showing a program not working. So I know that people either hate the program or they love the program, and I just hope no matter which camp you're in, you recognize that if you want to keep it, it's got to get fixed. And I just can't see how anyone could come to another conclusion after reading this report. I just, there are so many counts that are raised and so many findings raised in this report of deep concern, and I'm sure you feel a little under assault with the results of this report, but I think we all know the credibility of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, so I'm glad you're here, and we do want to hear from Commissioner McElroy as he responds to some of the things in your report. But I do want to ask you, Mr. Yonker, do you attempt in these reports to make a cost-benefit analysis related to the actual cost of a program? And the reason I ask that is I have a bill that has, which yields a bunch of corporate subsidies, and in that we heard the revenue estimate for that bill. And the thing that stuck out to me about Job Z in that revenue estimate wasn't even that it's not going where it was supposed to go, that there's not accountability, that there aren't business subsidy agreements, was that it costs $215 million before the program expires. And the way I think about that as a tax committee member is that $215 million could do something else for rural Minnesota, more LGA, I don't know. But do you attempt to weigh the objections with the price tag, because it's a very big price tag for this program, or is that not contained in the report? Mr. Yonker.
Madam Chair, I think the difficulty here is trying to figure out, trying to estimate how many jobs this program has created. I didn't get into it today, but we're critical of the kind of information that the Department of Employment and Economic Development has produced in terms of how many jobs they say the program has created. We think that it greatly overstates the number of jobs created, but it is very difficult to know exactly how many jobs were created, because it's not clear you can even go by the surveys that DEED has done. Businesses responding to those surveys probably have an interest in saying, yes, I wouldn't have done this but for job Z. And yet some said, we would have gone ahead without job Z. You suspect that possibly there would be, there actually were more that would have gone ahead without job Z than really reported on the survey. But what's the real number? And how many jobs would have been created? That's the difficulty here, and that's why you don't see us come up with a specific number as to the benefits and costs of the program. We can pin down what the costs are, but we can't pin down the benefits.
And Mr. Younger, Representative Fulberg raised a question about a fairness question that's unrelated to are they doing what's happening in the program, what the bill set out to do, is it being met? That's in your report. But Representative Fulberg raised another question, which was, you know, but is it fair? I mean, so that's a different issue, and that's what we debated back in the tax committee when some of us vehemently opposed it and some loved it, and we were all over the map bipartisanly as that bill passed. But does your report attempt to talk to the businesses who are not recipients of JobZ, who are instead competitors from JobZ, as Representative Fulberg has pointed out, who are put at an unfair disadvantage?
We looked at that issue, and I commented in my remarks about that. I am familiar, I think, with the example that Representative Fulberg came up with there. In fact, I can think of at least two examples in Grand Rapids, if that's where we're talking. And basically, there are cases where Grand Rapids turned down two projects because they said, we have competitors in our city who do the same thing. And one, they don't like the fact that you would be subsidized and we wouldn't be, and we don't think it's fair, and we don't necessarily think it's going to create jobs if we subsidize one business and that hurts business at the competitors in our city. What happened in both cases is similar projects or the same project went to cities that are fairly close to Grand Rapids, within 5, 10, 15 miles. 5 miles in the case of Cohasset, and so they participated in JobZ anyway. So the issue there for us is, does that really create jobs if we subsidize one business and it has competitors nearby who are potentially hurt by that effort?
Thank you, Mr. Younger. Okay, further questions for Mr. Younger? If not, we want to hear from Commissioner McElroy. Welcome.
Thank you.
And members, Commissioner McElroy was on the tax committee during the heyday of the creation of JobZ. We won't ask him how he voted.
The legislature and gone to be Commissioner of Finance at that time.
Right. You dodged the bullet. Commissioner McElroy, I believe it was Representative Magnus who carried the bill for the governor, as I recall, but you're right. You were no longer on the tax committee.
I
but you were
voted to the administration.
You were an excellent member of the tax committee. Welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Mark Rockus from our staff to join me. We have passed out, or having passed out, a blue sheet that will summarize some of our reactions to Mr. Younger's report. Let me first of all thank Mr. Younger for his work. We agree with virtually everything in their report. I do want to say it's not unusual, however, for fairly complex tax programs to need upkeep and maintenance and to need changes. On the same day that the legislative auditor released their report on JobZ, they released their report on Green Acres. And Green Acres has been in Minnesota tax law, I believe, for 40 years. And there were still significant changes and improvements and modifications that were needed for Green Acres. So I don't think it should be considered unusual that there is work that we need to do. We agree with the basic premise that JobZ needs to be improved, that the concerns raised in the legislative auditor's program need to be addressed. I want to thank Representative Marquardt for offering and introducing a bill that accomplishes that. House File 3599 covers the changes that are referred to on the blue sheet. Let me just address the issue. As a community broadly, as a whole state, we have an interest in the economic development in Greater Minnesota. Because the cost of having the disparity of income and disparity of opportunity that we have currently is one that we all bear. The family income per capita income in the state averaged in 2005 about $39,000, but it had a peak in the metro area of over $50,000 and a nadir in counties like Monoman County and Clearwater and Kennebec of $24,000. And it is not in our best interest as a state to have a robust 21st century economy in part of the state and a struggling, less advanced economy. And is jobs be the perfect tool? No. It is one tool in a toolbox of economic development. But I will tell you that in the years since we've had jobs be, we've done about 350 transactions. And there have been, more than just an anecdote, there has been a fairly long litany of successful projects all over the state that we sincerely believe would not have happened but for jobs. We also believe there's some projects that would have happened anyway. And we like the suggestion of the department that there be some stronger agreements, that there be some higher standards, and that the department have the authority to counsel the cities and ultimately, if necessary, to say no. But you know, I would be remiss in not citing some of the really outstanding success stories. And some of them are big, like Suzlon Windrotor and Pipestone that signed an agreement for 50 jobs in 2005. As of last Friday morning, they had 480 employees, and they'd like to be at 700 by July 1st, and these are good-paying, long-term jobs. Or companies like Daktronics in Redwood Falls that expanded to Minnesota from Brookings, South Dakota, committed to create 40 jobs, and today has 279 and is continuing to grow. Or smaller companies like the Hitch Dock in Jackson, Minnesota, that when they were on the farm outside of Jackson had 16 employees. Last week they had 90 employees and were quoted in the local paper as saying, but for jobs, we'd still be on the farm and we'd still have 16 employees. Now, I'm not happy that there were trash haulers and architects funded through this program. We can fix that. I also would use some caution in the long-term cost. In the same survey that Mr. Juncker quoted, we had about 90% of recipients say that although 57% said they could have expanded anyway, 90% said they couldn't have expanded to the extent they did under Jobs Aid. And with the changes recommended in Representative Marquardt's bill, we think that we can dramatically reduce that number. But I'd like to take a minute to go through the provisions that follow the legislative auditor's recommendation and that follow Representative Marquardt's bill, and then I'd be happy to stand for questions. The concerns of the legislative auditor fall into three general categories. First, the job Z participation, who gets to participate, and what's the level of the documentation. We agree that the deed should be required to approve subsidy agreements, and that provision is in Representative Marquardt's bill. Right. We think that we should be authorized to create some criteria and standards having to do with issues like competition or the number of jobs. Now, use some caution. A business expansion that creates five jobs in a little town like Lancaster, Minnesota, or Emily, or a lot of very small towns is a benefit to the community and may not have a large cost to the program. So we should use some caution in setting an absolute limit, but certainly there should be some strong criteria, and we would be committed to enforce those. We should ensure that business subsidy agreements are consistent, the goals have deadlines, and that there are goals. And we haven't had the authority to do that, in our opinion, in the past, although John may disagree with that. The community certainly have asserted their independence on this pretty strongly. Four, that we should create a mandatory subsidy agreement. We will do that. We don't believe that it's binding unless the legislature authorizes that, and that happens in Representative Marquardt's bill. And that we should consider project costs, benefits, and competitors in any but-for analysis, and we agree with that. We're particularly concerned about the issue of competition. John lists a number of projects, some of which I agree with and some of which I don't. couple of the farm implement projects that were done in northwestern Minnesota include significant assembly and distribution aspects and significant value added that separated them from their competitors. There are other projects that he lists that I fully agree had some real competitive issues. Secondly, we need to strengthen reporting and compliance, and we're committed to do that. Some things we can do without legislation, and John's report or the legislative auditor's report brought them to our attention, and those changes are underway. We have a new Jobs v. Business Subsidy report that I believe is up on the web currently and is in effect for this business cycle. We have streamlined the business review and urged the subzone administrators to get us information much more rapidly. There are two changes that the legislative auditor recommends that are just critically important. One is we currently do not have the authority to require business owners to certify the numbers that they give us under a penalty of some sanction, basically to sign a form that says, I guarantee that there are 10 new jobs or 20 or whatever the number is, and I certify that under penalty of law. We need that. And we think the numbers are probably a little closer than John does. In fact, in many cases, we think we've understated the numbers in some cases, but they're not as good as we'd like the numbers to be, and certification would help that dramatically. And so that's number three. The legislature should require businesses to attest or certify to the accuracy of the information. We need a stronger penalty for local government, and we don't think it needs to be dramatic, but we do have some problem with getting local governments to get us information, and some help when that would be appreciated, and that's in Representative Marquardt's bill. Number five, the state auditor needs the authority. We've been cooperating with the state auditor on their audit, but they do not have the authority to see some non-public data, and we would like to see that provided and support that provision of Representative Marquardt's bill. The legislative auditor is suggesting that we use unemployment insurance data to verify employment numbers. In order to do that, we need to essentially state under the Data Practices Act that we're going to do it, and we don't believe legislation is required for that. We'll modify the forms to notify businesses that as a condition of participating in Jobs V, they need to report their jobs under a consistent employee identification number and give us the authority to compare their unemployment insurance data. And we believe we can do that without further legislative authorization. And seven, the deed will provide better and more timely information. Legislation is not required. We have that change underway today. Program activity. The legislative auditor recommends that there should be a cap or a number of deal cap. We have some of the same concerns Representative Lanning had, that we aren't sure how we would determine that. And to some extent, the cost of the program depends on the number of benefits the community receives, and if we do our job right, they will be related. There isn't a tax forgiven for a project that wouldn't have happened, so if we have a better but-for relationship, we think that the need for a cap is less dramatic. However, if there are viable suggestions as to how to do a cap, we'd certainly work with the author. There isn't currently a cap in Representative Marquardt's bill. Second, the legislature should consider expanding program benefits to at least 10 years. The governor's recommendation for this is follow some of the legislative auditor's concerns about targeting. There has been discussion as to whether this project is needed in counties like Stearns County and Olmsted County that have been growing anyway, or whether it should be confined to counties that aren't growing. Well, not every county is uniform across its breadth. For example, western Stearns County and communities like Holding Ford and Avon don't look the same as the city of St. Cloud. And we've suggested defining counties that have had declining population or above average unemployment as targeted rural opportunity counties, and providing Job Z districts in those counties that would last 12 years, and providing Job Z benefits in non-targeted greater Minnesota counties of 10 years. Although the legislation current law would give us the authority to do districts that are shorter than that, and we think if we have the authority to approve districts, that we would negotiate shorter districts in some cases for projects with fewer jobs or less economic development benefits. The legislature should consider targeting the program to economically distressed areas. We think our targeted county approach accomplishes that. but we, and I believe we fight that that provision is in Representative Marquardt's bill, House File 3599. With that, we think we have addressed the concerns expressed by the legislative auditor to preserve the best features of JobZ, to keep the benefit in the many communities that have benefited, but to have it administered accurately and timely and more aggressively, and to avoid having it granted to animal hospitals or trash haulers. So with that, did I forget anything in, that we were supposed to say?
No.
All right. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Other questions for Commissioner McElroy? Representative Carlson.
Mr. McElroy, I'd be interested in you commenting about JobZ in a broader context. I represent some communities in the northwest suburbs. And you heard earlier Representative Colbert's comments where JobZ is in close proximity with other businesses. So I have businesses in and near my community that are competing statewide or even beyond the state borders with other Minnesota companies. And I'll hear from them about the disadvantage that they're placed under because of all of the various tax breaks when they're attempting to compete with a company that might be somewhere else in Minnesota, and yet they're sharing the same market statewide or internationally. And if you could comment on that, because I hear from members of our local chambers of commerce and so on when this issue comes up, and the fairness issue in a much broader context.
And we have the same challenge in border communities where people are competing with businesses in South Dakota or Iowa that have dramatically higher subsidies or dramatically lower taxes. And some of it I look to the success of economic indicators in those counties. The Hennepin County has an average per capita income of $59,000 compared to $39,000 statewide or $24,000 in many rural counties. And although the individual businesses don't may not benefit directly from that, the county has been quite prosperous. And our concern has been sort of macroeconomically looking at trying to provide some opportunities. In many cases, there are other costs in greater Minnesota, utility costs for electricity and telephone, for example, to most businesses in greater Minnesota are fairly dramatically higher. The cost of transporting their product to market or getting raw materials are generally higher than in the metro area. Most the economic model that our labor market analysts would indicate is that the cost of doing business in most manufacturing and service businesses is actually lower in the metro area because of proximity to suppliers, service providers, and markets. And so we think many of these things balance out. But like most states around us, that in order to have somewhat uniform economic development activity across the state, subsidies are more needed in targeted areas than they are in very prosperous areas.
Just a final comment. People in the business community in my area don't agree with what you just said. They're very concerned about the competition. They're very concerned about retaining their employees that are currently employed. So you get a different perspective, and I just put that on the table. When you're dealing with averages across the county, that may be one question, but when you're that individual business person that's trying to run his or her business and is competing with somebody that's getting all kinds of tax base breaks within their own state, I understand the border issue, but within their own state, they very quickly raise that fairness issue and what it means for the survival of their business and or the retention of their employees or perhaps even the ability to expand. And that's what I hear from my folks and others out there. I don't need a response. I just think that that's the counter viewpoint that should be put on the table as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson,
Mr. McElroy,
I understand that. It would be fair, though, and we'd be happy to work with you or a constituent. When you look at total costs like transportation and utilities and telecommunications, the differences may not be as great as your constituents think.
That probably depends on where their markets are.
Yeah.
And I'm hearing from them. They feel it's unfair, and that's all I'm saying.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You gave some of the disadvantages to business costs in the rural area, but they also have some advantages. I believe labor costs are probably less. Their building construction and property taxes and so forth, highway construction, all of those other things are also an offset to Ware. So there are some distinct advantages for the rural areas for businesses as well.
Mr. McElroy.
Chair, Representative Hart, that's true. Although unaided businesses have seemed to be growing more rapidly in metropolitan areas than they have in rural areas.
Representative Earhart.
Labor force, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Silver.
Well, Madam Chair and members, it seems to me that in order to be a successful business state, and I should be one who would be enthusiastic on this. But you always have to have the question of the but-for. And when you have abuse of that but-for, then you have a program that needs to be dramatically changed, dramatically administered differently, or take another look at. And what is the frustrating part of, from my perspective, is that there were programs in place that were targeted for the but-for of businesses to expansion, and it wasn't necessarily this type of a program. But those were set. But my question is, we've had the same type of controversy in my legislative career over the TIF district. And I did some checking again because we have TIF districts come before us all the time. And TIF districts have worked good in some places. When I was a mayor of a little town, we created a TIF district and saved a business. In fact, as you probably know, the business is for Benson Studios, Picture of Grace, and they probably ended up taking your kids. If you have kids in school, that business might be one of them that takes the picture. They expand it. We use the TIF district to do that, to help them out. Was it expanded or anything else? It did what it was supposed to do, and it took some blighted area and got it together. So in that process, in legislative career, at one time there was a huge cost to the state in the district. And now that's been changed. So if a local district or a local unit of government makes a TIF district, it's their cost in the state. And I want to ask the question from Commissioner, if that isn't the way we should consider this as an economic development tool for that particular district. So if a city makes the determination that they want to have a substitute or a subsidy of that particular business, then that's related to their cost instead of shifting that cost to somebody else.
Mr. McElroy.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg. The challenge often is that states with which we compete for job attraction, particularly South Dakota and Iowa, but in some cases other states, have fairly robust state programs, grant programs generally, that make it hard for us to compete with just TIF districts. I would, John Yunker gave the fact that about 91 or 92%, I think it is, of the cost of this current program is borne by the state. One reason for that in the early years is that buildings don't come on full property taxes until the second or third year that they're constructed. So that number will go up a little as the program matures. And in some communities, their share of the property tax is still fairly significant from their point of view, and they have some skin in the game. But I think the judgment we have to make is TIF only sufficient to allow us to compete? And the activity, the success stories we've had since we've had Jobs Aid that we didn't have prior to Jobs Aid lead us to believe that it is a stronger program and that it's worth the investment. But certainly you raised the issue correctly. The other interesting issue is that the Jobs Aid has, because of an opinion by the Attorney General, triggered the use of prevailing wage in the construction of buildings in Greater Minnesota, where prevailing wage might not otherwise have been paid. And that's probably, that clearly is a good thing for the building trades and for others in adding economic value in those communities where that's happened. That doesn't happen with TIF districts. But this is exactly the right debate to be having. We don't think we would have gotten Suzlon or Daktronics or a number of other projects with TIF alone.
Sure, I'm somewhat familiar with South Dakota since my in-laws are there and lives in Watertown and know very well the tax structure. My wife makes a check out of the South Dakota tax structure a couple times a year, and it's not a small tax bite. It's a big percentage of the income that comes from that particular state. But they also have in most of their particular economic development, it's a local property tax base.
Madam Chair, they also have a very significant state grant program. The wind turbine facility we lost to Aberdeen was based on a very, very significant state grant
that we don't have. And that's exactly my first part of my statement. Because we used to have that type of a program that was available, that was administered by the state. We know what the cost is. We have this administrative structure in. And I think if we're going to do that, that's the type of program we should be looking at.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner McElroy, in the legislative auditor's report and your report that you've also been doing, I like the comments that you made about TIF being here for 40 years and needing some corrections on an annual basis. Or Green Acres, I'm sorry, excuse me. I think that we're all in agreement that there needs to be some changes in Job Z. I think that as a rural member, it's kind of nice to see. Well, I think we got about six of us on this committee, so I kind of feel like I'm a little bit of a fish in a piranha bowl, but I will survive. Some of the side effects, and my question, I guess, or my comment is, with the legislative auditor and with the things that you've done, has there been any side effect study of what happens to these jobs when they come into a community? What are you seeing from the standpoint of housing? What are you seeing from the standpoint of students coming into the school district that these districts are starving for students for? What are you seeing for the side effects of the small businesses that are providing products that are used by these jobs, these businesses? We'll start with that.
Madam Chair, Simpson, we would like communities to be able to testify to that. And when Representative Marquardt's bill is heard, we know a number of communities have asked for the opportunity to testify. We have seen, particularly in communities where there have been larger projects like Daktronics in Redwood Falls or Suzlon in Pipestone or Central Boiler in Greenbush, that you've seen an impact on the real estate market particularly, and to some extent on schools. But I'd like communities to be able to testify that. They would have more individual information than we have.
Okay, Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. And I guess then to the legislative auditor, my comment would be when we do these types of audits, I think we need to be looking at the full picture and the full ramifications of what these reports are, and not only just the aspect of the direct result of just the Job Z, for an example. And I guess then in closing, Commissioner, what would you, if this provision is taken out of play, what do you see happening in rural Minnesota, and what do you see, what would your reaction be to something to replace it? Because we're going to have to do something.
Mr. McElroy.
Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, we strongly advocate for continuing Job Z. We think it's better to fix it and to keep it in place because it has success. And we have, in conversation both with prospects that we're working with and prospects that our communities are working with, we know a number of companies that are waiting to see some clarity before moving ahead, but that it would have a negative impact. If in the wisdom of the legislature the program ends, we'll do our best to continue doing economic development. We'll use TIF districts. If we're left any resources in the Minnesota Investment Fund, we will use that. We'll use what local revolving loan funds exist around the state. But we would have grave difficulty competing for regional competitive projects in industries like wind power, alternative energy, biofuels, and wind-related manufacturing, where kind of the additional capacity of Job Z has helped us be competitive.
Representative Simpson?
That's all at this time. Thank you.
Okay, and we want to hear from the public on this. Anybody for or against, or I guess we're not on a bill. We're on the OLA report. Does anybody want to comment from the public? I know Representative Earhart mentioned the business community. Maybe they want to comment. The cities. And Representative Simpson, I was counting 12 of 26 members of this committee are Greater Minnesota.
All right.
So it's 12 of 26. We're not quite in half.
I just looked around and
yes, and I don't know, you know.
Just keep filtering.
Maybe they don't care about Job Z because they're not here defending it. I don't know. But 12 of 26 are in the 80 counties that qualify to use Job Z. So I think we've got some representation for those members to start speaking up here. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go first. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities. As you know, we're the statewide organization representing all 854 cities across the state. As you might guess, our cities are kind of a mixed bag on this, but look at it really as just another economic development tool in the toolbox. We really want to be on record expressing our concerns about what's being proposed in your legislation, more along the lines of repealing it, and actually are real supportive of a lot that is actually in the Mark Wharton bill that hopefully you'll hear later on this session. Like I said before, for a lot of our cities, Job Z has been a good tool in the toolbox, and to end the program straight on is, I guess for a lot of our cities, what they complain about is the messages that they get from the legislature on this program, going back since its conception. So I just know that's been a real frustration for them generally. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. O'Rourke, I feel like I should respond to that because, you know, I've been one of the loudest voices on this program since its inception. And I think that's fair to say that there's been mixed messages because we are of a mixed mind. I mean, if we all agreed, there would be no mixed message. So I think that's a legitimate frustration for the cities to have. For those who served on this committee when Job Z came into being, I can look around at people like Representative Earhart and Representative Mullery and I and Representative Krenke, all kinds of folks. When he was here, we all fought it together. We lost. and we actually anticipated a lot of these problems that would come to fruition, that there wouldn't be accountability, that it would just mostly go to places that many people would use the program for jobs they were going to have anyhow. So we're watching this now play out. This was a top initiative of Governor Pawlenty's, and I think it was noteworthy that Representative Abrams then taxed here, did not carry the legislation, and instead another legislator did. But, you know, as far as the mixed message, I do want to clear something up for the public. I mean, the bill that I have does not repeal Job Z. Not immediately. It lets all those who are out there still functioning and playing by the rules clock out. Would I like to completely eliminate Job Z? Yes. I mean, I never supported it from the beginning, but we have members here who absolutely at this table would like to repeal it completely, and members who would like to not only keep it how it is, but add more years. So, you know, it is difficult for the cities, and I want you to know that, but we are all very different people, and we have very different feelings on this. And I understand the frustration for the local units of government. I do just want to throw in one piece for more testimony for people and members to think about. You know, one of the things that's been frustrating is during the LGA cuts to watch how that played out in rural Minnesota and to now think that, you know, that $250 million that's going to go into this program could go into that instead, potentially. And I think cities would be hard-pressed if they had to come to the mic and pick which one of those they'd like tonight. So, you know, I just think that that is the role of the tax community to keep thinking about all this, but we are in a deficit. And the parallels to tax increment financing districts, I think, in financing, we should all think about that because the programs like Green Acres and tax increment financing and the egg, Metro Egg Preserves, fiscal disparities, I mean, I could vote for getting rid of all those. They're all moving subsidies and things around. But, you know, the other programs all are not job creation programs. That's not really what they're for. Job Z was supposed to create jobs, and it's really you read the OLA report, it's really not doing that, except in some cases, and there's a very large price tag. So, you know, I know this is a very frustrating topic for members, and both caucuses are very divided on this issue. We have strong for and against in both parties. And so I just want to tell you that I understand the frustration for the cities in trying to figure this all out, but the deficit is requiring, I think, a higher level of scrutiny now going forward in this area. Before we go on, Representative Rukavina to this point? No, he's passing. Okay. And thank you, Ms. O'Rourke, because I know you representing all the cities. You're in a very tough situation with this proposal. Yes.
Madam Chair, members, Holly Thompson with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, 80 cities outside the metro area. Our cities support economic development programming in Greater Minnesota. I would say that, you know, many of our cities feel that there are many advantages to this program, and this is one of the programs that, you know, supported by economic development. However, our cities do recognize that there are problems with this program as well. But we would support not eliminating future business subsidy agreements and support improving the program and keeping it.
Thank you for that. Representative Forward.
Madam Chair, I'd like to see them have the choice.
We won't put her on the spot on that one today. You know, but Representative Solberg as a Ways and Means Chair is a good person to bring it up, because, folks, if the deficit situation doesn't get better, those are the choices we're all going to make. Is after we get through this year and cuts, what are we going to cut next? So, I mean, people have to start thinking long-term about the tails in these programs, and it is the tax committee who's going to have to work through all this, just not this year, then it's the next. Thank you for your testimony. Is there other testimony on Job B? Anyone from the business community want to weigh in? They're smiling back there, but they're not coming forward. What's up, Earhart?
Hey, sure, let's calm down. I mean, we got the...
Well, who would you like?
We got the business partnership sitting up there.
That's part of it.
Business partnership, and we've got the Minnesota Chamber, and then we've got the taxpayers lady out in the audience.
Okay.
We've got to hear from these people.
Sure. Does anybody want to come down? Is the taxpayers lady here, or the Minnesota Business Partnership, or the Chamber? Representative Earhart really wants to hear from you. And then, members, you know what we're going to do after we finish public testimony on this report? We're going to go to, a little bit more testimony on pieces that might be in Representative Carlson's bill, but the text that I have is an amendment. But we'll finish up the Job Z report here. Okay, Ms. Larson, welcome.
Madam Chair, members, Jill Larson with Minnesota Business Partnership. I was going to wait to testify on your other bill, and I still am, I hope. So
yes, sure, I'll be able to do that next.
To speak about Job Z. Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, the partnership, my understanding back when Job Z was originally implemented, didn't take a position. I think our position this year on the issue is that I think it's clear that the program probably needs some tweaks. It isn't perfect. There's some legitimate concerns with the program, but I think we want to do everything we can to grow jobs in this state. And we know that we're competing not only with other states for jobs, but other countries as well. And we can't really unilaterally disarm. I mean, in a perfect world, we probably wouldn't have the need for something like this. But other states are doing this. They are trying to take jobs from Minnesota. And so I think our feeling is that if we can adjust the program to address some of the concerns that were laid out in the auditor's report, but still keep a program that I think is doing some good in rural Minnesota, that we should probably do that rather than throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And like Ms. Larson, we did not, the Minnesota Chamber did not take a position back when Job Z was created. Having said that, I know many of our local chambers of commerce around the state in greater Minnesota have worked well with Job Z, think it's a very important tool for them to have to increase jobs and create jobs in greater Minnesota. So, we have to recognize that and again, agree with Ms. Larson's comments that this is another tool that Minnesota needs to, you know, keep and maintain and grow jobs in the state.
Representative Earhart.
I thank you, Madam Chair. So what you two are both saying is that if you have adjustments in this program, you are going to take a position this time in favor of Job Z.
Mr. Hessian, Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, the Minnesota Chamber still does not have a position on Job Z. Again, all I can relate is what we hear when we travel around the state, talking to some of our local chambers and members. And again, many local chambers of commerce around the state think it's a very important tool to have and to use.
Well, Mayor, you do listen to your local chambers all the time, don't you? So, come down on an issue and the way your members are voting and the way they want you to perform or no?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, as you might expect, we have some members on the other side of the issue as well, and again, that is essentially why we don't have a position on the subject.
Okay. We've got Lanning, Demmer, then Carlson, and you know, I just want to point out, Mr. Hesse and Ms. Larson are in the same position Ms. O'Rourke was when she testified, which is they have members who both benefit and are harmed by this program. The cities do as well. They have, you know, these are difficult issues. So I guess, you know, as we make our decision, and we are going to make a decision on this year, we have to remember that we all here have to do what we think is right and not put it on these groups to kind of weigh in, because they're really not able to. They have a bunch of members who are in Job Z and a bunch who think it's really unfair that their competitors are in Job Z. So I think we just all need to keep that in mind as we resolve the Job Z issue this year. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is to our testifiers plus anyone else, I guess. I think we all like to talk about the importance of jobs, that we all want to see Minnesota jobs grow and not go down. We really have to take a look, it seems to me, at what are the factors that can affect and help us create jobs. The tax climate is one. Minnesota has a reputation with the tax climate that many times is not viewed as one that's conducive to job creation. We can look at the regulatory environment. Many times our regulatory environment discourages job creation. Certainly the investment we make in education is going to make a huge difference. But I think we need to ask ourselves, is it really realistic in this day and age that Minnesota not have some viable incentives to create jobs? And I believe that we need incentives. In the case of TIF, TIF is used much less because of tightening down TIF over the years. You talk to any city, they'll tell you that they can't use TIF like they used to because of the changes we've made. And there was a situation where we needed to tighten some things down, we did. We've taken away the incentive many times with regard to TIF. We obviously need to make some changes with our Job Z program to tighten it down. But folks, we need to keep in mind that the reality is that unless Minnesota is willing to provide some incentives, we're going to have a very difficult time creating the jobs we all want.
Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I've got to agree with Representative Lanning, but I guess my comments are going to be, you know, we all have situations probably in our district, and I do, where there are some companies utilizing Job Z that I think is very appropriate, Madam Chair, where that would not have expanded would not be there. And I'm thinking about a couple situations that are very unique businesses that have no competition that I'm aware of within the state, and just simply created opportunity. I can also think, Madam Chair, of a couple situations where I had to scratch my head when I heard they were getting Job Z and say, does that make sense? When there's a competitor in a nearby town or somebody doing a similar business in a nearby town or county or whatever. And so I think what it points out is we have to have the courage, Madam Chair, to say that there's some changes maybe need to be made, but we need to allow deed, or we need to ourselves put some parameters in place to tighten this up so that it's useful where it's useful, and in places where it maybe doesn't make sense, we've got to be willing to say no, that we can't do this, and because it does create unfair competition, that sort of thing. But I think to a certain extent, I think we're abdicating our responsibility if we're just going to say, get rid of the whole thing. I mean, it needs some changes. We've had some situations where maybe it's been utilized where it hasn't been. So rather than making tough choices about that, rather than trying to allow the department or allow DE, let's say, to make some choices or to be in a position of scrutinizing a little closer, we're going to do away with it because we don't want to have to worry about that. And I think that would be unfortunate. Because there are some situations where it really has been successful, and it really has driven some new business and expanded some existing business in unique ways. And you can put this into other categories. Personally, myself, small business development grants, some of this through federal dollars, some through state dollars, have been very, very successful and useful in our small communities. And they're targeted, and they're very helpful. But sometimes that little bit of incentive is what you need to get those private dollars invested, which is beneficial. And to just say that there's been some abuses, let's get rid of the whole program, Madam Chair, I just think that would be, I don't know if irresponsible is not the right word. It would be unfortunate, because I think we've got something here that could be worked with. And I think if each one of us thinks about those situations, I think we can all say that, my golly, this would have been a good place. This was a good use of it. On the other hand, this one wasn't. And I think some of these recommendations that we're seeing that, that Commissioner, McElroy and the department are looking at, I think makes some sense. So I would just caution us to be too quick to say, let's just throw it out if we're not willing to make tough choices and just say, let's make this work better.
Thank you. Representative Carlson and Dela Cora.
Madam Chair, I think the Chamber made the point that I was hoping they would make, and that was that there is not total unanimity in the business community relative to the job fee, and probably in a way acknowledging some of the points that I was making earlier about some of the problems that business people, chamber members, by the way, that's where I have most of my contact with them. There's several chambers up my way have some viewpoints that are a little bit different from the standpoint of a level playing field, but I'll just stop there.
Thank you. Representative LaForce.
Well, Madam Chair, briefly, obviously this has engendered a lot of discussion. You have boldly certainly prodded us to consider this issue. But from my perspective, with respect to Job Z and TIF and the like, it seems to me the analysis often falls short. I commend the OLA on a thorough report, but it seems to me, again, the scope is too limited. We seem to be fixated on, for example, well, was a job created or were jobs created? And I don't trivialize that. If it was your area that had some jobs created because of Job Z, certainly that's important to you. But what I would like to know in examining Job Z, TIF, and everything else you've placed on the table, and I don't know the answer to this, I want to know if data exists that really answer the real question in my mind, and is that does our economy benefit overall? Are we better off for all these subsidies? I mean, frankly, Ms. Larson, I don't agree with the attitude that says, well, the other jurisdictions do it, so we ought to do it. There is scholarly data available from other jurisdictions that clearly indicate that a lot of the handouts that they've given, the subsidies year after year, really don't benefit the economy. And I know sometimes it's hard to visualize because when you look at the new factory or you cut the ribbon, I mean, certainly there's tangible evidence there. But really the analysis ought to go deeper than that, Madam Chair. And I hope at some point, I don't know if it's the Federal Reserve Bank with Dr. Rolnick or perhaps the University of Minnesota. I'm just curious, and I don't know if you have an answer as to whether detailed analysis exists as to whether or not this really benefits our economy and not just, for example, does it create jobs, which I think is one issue, but I think there's a deeper issue to explore that you have actually raised a profile of about, well, perhaps if we lower the overall tax rate, will that be better?
Thank you for that, Representative LaForce, and I hope we're going to spend a lot of time on those questions you just raised. Representative Wolfire.
So, Madam Chair, members, maybe this question is for Mr. Hesse. I live in Shannon Falls. We've had Job Z for the entire time. We've yet to get one, you know, offer. So I guess maybe it's on Representative DeLaForest's point. I mean, I would hate for us to talk about Job Z as, you know, it's working great in rural Minnesota, and when, in fact, at least in the town I live in, it hasn't helped at all. So, I mean, can you comment on, are there other communities where there's been no action, even though we've had Job Z this whole time?
Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair and Representative Wolfswager, I
believe you're not unique. It has worked better in some areas than in others, and I'm not sure why. I don't have any information from the local chambers that we visit with on what they think the reasons for success are or for reasons for failure are. But it is clear that it works. Some communities it works really well, and others so far have not had very much success.
Representative Mallory.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just wondering, I missed something. Are we going around? I seem to be one of about two that haven't talked on this. Are we supposed to or something? Or?
No need to. I think that was it. Are we done? Anyone else? Anyone from the public? If anybody else wants to weigh in on the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report on JOBZ? Okay. I want to thank the Office of the Legislative Auditor for being with us today and Mr. McElroy. We are going to wade into JOBZ once again, but we wanted to hear the report before we actually took action, and so we appreciate that, and we wanted to hear the Commissioner's response, so thank you. Okay, and so with that, members, I'm going to move, I guess I'm not moving a bill. We are next going to pass out an amendment I have for Representative Carlson's bill. Okay, so if the pages could pass this out. And the reason I'm going to do this, members, and hang on to it, because we don't have Representative Carlson's bill ahead of us, but before we do Representative Carlson's bill, we need to take public testimony on tax provisions that are that I'm going to attempt to add. And so this amendment allows everybody in the room to see what motion I am going to make after Representative Carlson walks through his bill. And these are provisions that are contained in House File 4103, and we have it on the calendar to hear all the public testimony on that bill tonight, but in fairness to all the chairs who are here and Representative Carlson, we want to get his bill done tonight for sure. And to do that, it's only fair to hear the testimony on the tax provisions that would get added tonight. So they're being passed out now so that folks can testify, and I will just tell the business community who's here what they are. They should be coming to the back of the room. So to be clear on this, I know I can see some confused faces. We have next on the agenda testimony on House File 4103, which we'll do, but we're not going to do everything in that bill. That was a large corporate subsidy, business subsidy bill with the lowering of the corporate tax rate and abolishing the AMT. That would take a lot of time to get through all that testimony, and then Representative Carlson and all the fiscal chairs would still be waiting. So instead, we're going to take testimony on the amendment I'm going to offer. So the provisions in there, I think what's best to do is we'll have Mr. Michael walk through this amendment, even though it's not being offered right now. It's going to be offered later tonight. So everybody who's here can understand what's in it. And in a nutshell, it's the FOC, royalty, tax haven, and a mutual fund cap removal. Okay, those are the four provisions. But they were all in the corporate subsidy bill that I had introduced before that we never got to public testimony on. We had a lot of debate on it amongst members, but we never took public testimony. So I thought in fairness, before the tax committee attempted to add FOC to Representative Carlson's bill here tonight, the business community should have an opportunity to testify on those provisions. And they heard them all. The bill was unveiled, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, and folks saw it then. So, if folks understand what I'm doing here, I'm going to go to Mr. Michael to explain this amendment, even though Representative Carlson's bill is not ahead of us, so that the business community can testify on it before we act. Mr. Michael.
What's the number?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll quickly go through this. I don't know if the summary of it has been handed out, but essentially it consists of four provisions, three of which were in 4103 and one of which is a partial version of a governor's recommendation. Just going through them in order, section one is an increase in the...
Michael, I'm sorry, I apologize. We thought the pages had the summary. Can you give them the summary? We're going to get that to members real quick here first. Okay. I apologize. I thought all the members had that in front of them. They have the amendment, But I think it's easier for us to just look at the one pager that Mr. Michael has created defining what the amendment does. So if we can get that to members quick. So if everyone, as you're getting it, Mr. Michael, we now have it in front of us for just a second.
Madam Chair, is this 1555 of the amendment to
reference?
Yeah, 41 seconds. Yes, but now you're going to get right behind you. Josh is going to hand you the actual summary, so you can understand what I'm doing. We'll put the rest out back for the business community as well to see the summary of the provision. Okay, so do all members now have this summary? Okay, Mr. Michael, sorry about that. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, there are essentially four provisions here. Section 1 is a modified version of a governor's recommendation to increase securities registration fee on mutual funds. The governor's bill had repealed that completely, and instead in this bill, it's increased by roughly $6 million, from $25.6 million to $31.385 million per year. Second provision is the tax haven the provision from 4103. Essentially, this adopts a list of tax havens that comes from the OECD and the IRS and provides that any foreign corporation that's incorporated in one of those countries or does enough business in one of those countries to be subject to jurisdiction to tax would be treated like a domestic corporation, which means that their income and apportionment factors would be included in the combined report for the unitary business. The third provision is the phase out and repeal of the foreign royalty subtraction. This is the 80% deduction for payments received either from FOCs or from foreign corporations for the use of things like intellectual property or payments for other intangibles. And what this provision does is, first, for tax year 08, that's the current tax year, it restricts it to actually payments for use of intangibles outside the United States. This is similar to what the governor recommended for as part of his bill. But then for tax year 09, the subtraction is completely repealed, which goes beyond what the governor did. The fourth provision is the FOC provision, which simply repeals the FOC definition and special treatment effective for tax year 08.
Okay. So, for members, it's not before us, but we want to take, this is fully contained in House File 4103, public testimony from, there might be someone who's not from the business community who wants to testify on these provisions, but I doubt it. I think this is the Minnesota business community who would want to testify on these provisions, and I believe they have come tonight to testify on a lot more than these provisions, but we want to take testimony on FOCs, royalties, the tax haven, and the securities tax. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any guess as to how much we're raising here?
Just coming right behind you. Next handout. These provisions together are $201 million and some thousands, and they're just being handed out now, and then we'll put the extras in the back for folks over here from the public. So this, my intention is to add this amendment with these provisions at this price tag to Representative Carlson's bill, but we're first going to take public testimony. So is there anyone here who would like to testify on these provisions?
$10.
Yes,
thank you, Madam Speaker. As somebody's coming on down the road, President Paulson and I were looking for the rate reduction that we spoke of earlier. Is it in this bill and we're missing it, or is it going to be?
I'm not offering that tonight. So I'm just taking public testimony on these provisions, and you certainly can offer that when we are doing amendments on Representative Carlson's bill. That would be in order to be a tax amendment.
Okay.
Ms. Larson. Thank you.
Nice to see you again. It's been a while.
For those of you that forgot, I'm Phil Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Madam Chair, just a question first, if I may. Is it my understanding that the corporate rate reduction is now not in this amendment, correct?
That's what Mr. Zellers was, Representative Zellers was just saying. And that may come up when we move Representative Carlson's bill, who, when we're done with public testimony, he's going to join us at the table and walk through his deficit reduction bill, and we're going to add tax provision. And if I prevail, this is what would go on. I may not, but certainly any member of this committee could offer that amendment. That would be in order, but that's not what we're doing here now. We're not doing the full House File 4103. It's just the provisions that Mr. Michael just walked through.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Then I don't have to say thank you for cutting the rate. No, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, we do still oppose this amendment. Appreciate you taking out the repeal of the R&D credit. I understand that has caused a lot of concern. But
Ms. Larson, I want to interrupt you. I apologize. I'm not taking anything out. This is going to be an amendment to Representative Carlson's bill.
Thank you.
All those other business subsidy and corporate subsidy issues and rate cuts and AMT repeals are all alive for the omnibus tax bill.
And
this is only to balance the budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Larson.
Okay. Madam Chair, we do oppose House File 4103, both in terms of the overall net tax increase of was $170 million for this biennium, nearly $300 million for the next biennium, the last revenue note that I saw. And also because of the overall negative impact that the repealers would have on many of Minnesota's job providers. The repeal of the R&D credit and also, importantly, the repeal of the foreign royalty deduction would harm many of Minnesota's best and largest employers. The R&D credit and the foreign royalty deduction can work in concert together to create an incentive for employers to create technology here and basically to sell it overseas. The development of that intellectual property in Minnesota is then licensed overseas, and having those jobs here to create that technology, that creates high-paying jobs here in Minnesota, jobs like for engineers, scientists, and the kind of high-paying jobs that we want to encourage to be here in Minnesota. We think that if this bill were to pass, it would definitely put Minnesota at a competitive disadvantage. We all know we're competing globally to attract new jobs here, and frankly, we're competing to keep the jobs here that we have here now. Eliminating incentives to grow medical technology, bioscience, and manufacturing jobs in Minnesota, we believe, is counterproductive. These businesses can move their R&D operations out of state, taking with them the high-paying jobs that produce income and sales tax for the revenue. Eliminating the foreign royalty deduction could encourage companies to locate their intellectual property and R&D functions in other countries, and therefore Minnesota would no longer receive any of the tax income from the royalties that the companies earn. And Representative DeLaForest, you mentioned earlier about the overall impact on Minnesota's economy, and we believe that the passage of these provisions, these repealers, would not only harm some specific Minnesota employers, but would have a negative ripple effect on other Minnesota employers, small employers that are the suppliers and the vendors for some of these larger companies. We're also hearing from other states, other organizations that we work with across the country that have heard about this bill, and I think when we're talking about repealing the R&D credit, repealing the foreign wealth deduction, that I think will have a chilling effect on job growth here, both on the companies that are currently located here and are trying to decide where to expand, but also on companies that might not be here yet, but might be looking to move here. And we just think that this bill sends a bad message. And given the state of our economy right now, we're afraid that this proposal will make a bad economic situation worse by eliminating the incentives that we currently have to create these high-tech, high-wage jobs. Couple of comments, Madam Chair, about the new definition of domestic corporation, expanding the definition to include foreign corporations. This appears to be an attempt to get to worldwide unitary again. We're concerned that
the company with foreign operations would have its foreign income tax simply because they're doing business in one of these so-called tax haven countries. And we're also very concerned that the provision would allow the Commissioner of Revenue to determine what in fact is a tax haven country. We think that raises some constitutional questions. This proposal with respect to the tax haven language goes farther than any other state. A couple of other states have similar provisions. Montana, I think, has something like this, but they require that the corporation actually be incorporated in the tax haven country. They don't allow their Commissioner of Revenue to designate tax haven countries. So this goes far beyond what any other state has. And so that causes some great concern. On the foreign operating corporation provision, this proposal goes beyond the agreement that was in last year's tax bill. And we are not opposed to those changes that were agreed to in last year's bill, but this repeals entirely the foreign operating corporation provision, and we think that that will put U.S. companies at a competitive disadvantage. The whole reason that was put into place 20-some years ago was to try to level the playing field for domestic companies versus foreign companies, which takes away that advantage. Finally, Madam Chair, we agree that Minnesota's tax system probably needs to have some changes made to it to adapt to 21st century economy. And we all agree that the corporate income tax is a very aggressive and volatile tax. We're concerned, frankly, that this proposal will make the corporate tax more volatile than it already is. We do support efforts to reduce the rate. We support efforts to move us more quickly to apportioning income based on sales alone, the so-called single sales factor that is supported in a bipartisan fashion here. And finally, members, we think a change of this significance deserves more study. We currently have two commissions, either in process or soon to be in process. The Budget Trends Study Commission is looking at Minnesota's tax revenue system. The governor's going to have his tax commission. We respectfully ask that you wait and see what recommendations come out of those commissions before we would make a tax change of this significance. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I will try to stick to your bill, and it will obviously apply to the amendment as well. But there are a couple of positive changes in your bill from the Chamber's point of view. Obviously, the rate reduction we think is a long overdue tax change in Minnesota. Minnesota has the fourth highest corporate income tax rate in the country, if you include the District of Columbia. And recently, the Tax Foundation, a D.C. organization, looked at the corporate income tax rate of states and countries. And we have if you include D.C., we would have the fourth highest income tax rate, corporate income tax rate, in any of the OECD countries once you expand the U.S. to include all the states. So we have a high corporate income tax rate here in Minnesota, which obviously we think should deserve some work and some attention. Also, we support eliminating the corporate AMT. There's gets rid of some complexity in the tax and should ease the administrative burden of taxpayers and the department. So those are the couple of positive elements that we see in your tax bill. Now, let me touch on a few of the negatives with respect to foreign operating corporations. We continue to believe that maintaining the FOC structure is important. As Ms. Larson said, the purpose back in 1988 or so was to place U.S. companies operating overseas at an equal footing with companies with their foreign competitors that are incorporated outside the U.S. That's still important today. There's some general agreement on tightening up of the FOC structure. Would urge you to look at that rather than repealing the FOC statute in its entirety. On the foreign royalty deduction, the purpose of the deduction is to incent companies to develop their technology and intellectual property here in Minnesota with all the R&D jobs and technology jobs that go along with that, and then license that technology to foreign subsidiaries that then will use it for manufacturing purposes. The net result is Minnesota has been able to locate and expand many, many high-paying jobs in the state because of this, this provision and how it works and dovetails with the R&D credit. So changing the deductibility of foreign royalties, we think, could jeopardize this R&D investment that Minnesota has benefited from for many, many years. The R&D credit also similar negative impact to Minnesota. 40 states have R&D credits, many of which are more generous than Minnesota's. For example, California has a 15% credit, Hawaii a 20% credit, Indiana 15, New Jersey 10, North Dakota 8, Rhode Island 22.5. But again, the foreign royalty deduction and the R&D credit, we think, work together. And one of the reasons why we think Minnesota's been able to get away with a lower level of a credit over the years is because the foreign royalty deduction is in place. So again, we think those two pieces of tax policy are very important to locating the high technology research and development jobs that are here and that are growing. Switching to the tax haven and the definition of domestic corporations, again, we agree with Ms. Larson's comments that it appears that these two sections were designed to enact a worldwide combined reporting. And as we testified last year, that certainly adds more complexity to the tax system that members of ours have opposed. With respect to the tax haven provision, the impression that I think the legislation gives is that countries on the list, this list are bad, you know, that they have either because they have a low tax rate or they possibly don't share tax information with the U.S. or other countries.
Excuse me, Mr. Hesse, that's usually someone's cell phone. Even if you have it on vibrate, it can be picked up like that. So if you have one on, please shut it off so we can hear Mr. Hesse's testimony. Thank you.
Again, to date, here's the information that we've received with respect to the tax haven and definition of domestic corporation provisions. Companies aren't operating in these so-called tax haven countries to shield U.S. income. You know, they can't shift U.S. income outside the U.S. without having an IRS tax complication or tax issue. Second, that this provision would clearly tax some foreign income, you know, resulting in added complexity, whether it's currency translations, profit and translations of profits and losses, value in foreign property, etc. Third, it has an extremely low nexus threshold. And one example a member of ours provided was if there's a German subsidiary of a consumer products company that sells a tube of toothpaste to a customer in Luxembourg, it will now have, that German company will now have Minnesota corporate income tax liability. Because of how the constitutional nexus requirements of that section of the definition of corporate, a domestic corporation operate, they believe that that company would have a Minnesota tax liability, even if it has no presence in Minnesota. And how will the department know about that transaction and be able to audit that? We're not too sure about. And it also gives the commissioner broad authority to designate a country as a tax haven, even where we haven't seen this type of legislation in other, as we, in the Barson said, we haven't seen this type of legislation in other states. In talking to some of the national folks that have worked on similar legislation around the country, it seems that there are only three countries that are now left on the uncooperative tax haven list as issued by the OECD. And so having a longer list in Minnesota statute seems to, again, have the perception that there are many more entities out there that may be more uncooperative tax havens in nature, but in reality, very few exist. So in summary, Madam Chair and members, we do believe that this legislation goes too far with respect to a variety of things, the Foreign Operating Corporation Statute, the Foreign Royalty Deduction, the R&D credit. Those have been successful tax policy choices and decisions that this legislature has made over the years. We've been lucky. We have 20 Fortune 500 companies headquartered in this state, companies that are typically have lots of high-paying technology and R&D facilities and jobs here. We think those could be in jeopardy if the foreign royalty deduction, the R&D credits, are not available. That will also not only cause just the loss of jobs, but the personal income tax revenue and other revenues that go along with them. And I don't think we can just think of the companies that immediately benefit from those provisions, but also think of companies that are that want to be the next Fortune 500 company headquartered in Minnesota. If those companies see these deductions and credits done away with, they most likely will find another place to grow and create those high-paying technology jobs. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there further public testifiers on the provisions that I've laid out ahead of everyone here? If there is, please come down. If you don't want to now, you can do that when we get to that point in Rep. Sam Carlson's bill. Thank you, Mr. Hesse. Thanks. Thank you, Ms. Larson. And with that, Rep. Sam Carlson, I think we're ready for your 360-page bill.
Not the biggest.
No, not the biggest.
I have
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, but big enough.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that House File 1812 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Representative Carlson moves House File 1812. I hope all members caught the number of that bill in that motion. House File 1812.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that number was chosen specifically. I was meeting with Joanna Dornfield, by the way, who's the committee administrator from the Finance Committee, and she's here tonight, and we were looking for a vehicle, and there were several that I had to choose from, and that, as a former social studies teacher, that number had a certain attraction to it. Although after this is over, I don't think there's any plan to burn the White House or anything like that.
Representative Mullery.
Some of the outcomes of the War of 1812.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, that was my question. If he thought this bill was going to go up in flames.
But Madam Chair, we did win the Battle of New Orleans.
Okay. So
it was part of what's known as the War of 1812.
And Representative Carlson, we're going to...
Well, on a very serious note, let me ask you a question. I have a couple of ways that I can approach it. I've got a broad overview. Then I can also highlight some of the main provisions in each of the divisions, or the articles of the bill that reflect the division reports. What is your pleasure? How much detail would you like?
Representative Carlson, we'll do whatever you want. I just think this committee is going to spend its time this evening on fees and taxes, and that's what we're going to try to get our heads around. As members know, the Representative Krenke and Senator Pogemiller passed a bill that brought fees through this committee, and so they're still through this committee. So those are in sprinkled throughout, but we mostly want to focus on putting the tax amendment onto your bill to balance the whole budget out. So whatever you'd like to do with
well,
that.
Well, sure, what I'll do then is just give a broad overview so that people know what the bill is about and point out two things. Then I do have several of the division chairs with us here this evening that should there be questions to their article, their part of the bill, they will be able to comment, and we also have the fiscal staff present, or will be shortly if they're upstairs, who staff the various finance divisions.
Madam Chair.
So, Madam Chair, then I'll just do the shorter overview, if you will.
Okay. Representative Carlson, if I may, I think Representative Simpson has a preliminary question before you start that. Representative Simpson.
Well, not, thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe not a question, more like a comment. As a minority has had the opportunity to see this for about 30 minutes, I'd appreciate it if we would have the opportunity to hear a little bit about what's in it. If you intend to mark this up tonight. If you plan on marking this up as a minority lead, I would like to ask for a 30-minute recess so we can at least talk about it and maybe have an amendment or two to go again.
Okay. You know, let's just think about this here for a second. Representative Carlson, majority members who do not serve on finance or
or the other divisions have not seen this either. So I think that's certainly appropriate. But we're again trying to stay on taxes and fees in this committee. So we're adding the paying for it part of the bill. So I do think Representative Simpson's making a good argument to have a little more overview of what's in the bill. So if that's okay with you, we'll proceed and get the overview so we understand it a little bit. A little more detail.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, and it's easy for me to combine the two then, Madam Chair. But the House budget proposal is balanced and reflects the critical priorities of the state. And the plan is a reasonable combination of budget reductions, the reductions, use of reserve funds, and after this evening's meeting, increased revenues by closing some corporate tax loopholes. There are no general tax increases in the proposal, and we keep our commitments to schools, health care, and college students. During a time of economic downturn, there is an appropriate use of rainy day funds to help address the budget deficit. The plan doesn't simply protect our schools, but reprioritizes resources and invests the equivalent of an additional 1% in the funding formula for approximately $51 per pupil statewide. We incorporate several of the governor's recommendations, but differ with him in key areas. We minimize his cuts to higher education, which should allow our universities to keep tuition stable. The plan does not incorporate the governor's proposed cuts to nursing homes and the disabled. In fact, the House proposal includes a 2% cost of living increase for nursing home workers at a time when we are investing in a comprehensive health care system and are advancing needed reform proposals. It is critical we strongly support our nursing home workers who are responsible for the daily care of our elderly. The proposal includes budget reductions to the state agencies of approximately 3% and includes reductions to the legislative budget as well. On the bottom line, House File 1812 makes nearly $135 million in cuts to protect the Health Care Access Fund while utilizing $350 million from the cash flow account and $250 million from the reserve account. Like the governor, House File 1812 leaves $403 million in the reserve account, so we're exactly the same in that regard. Then, Madam Chair, I'll make a few key points then for your request about each of the articles. Articles 1 and 2, which are the K-12 section, it provides a one-time increase, as I mentioned earlier, of $51 per pupil to all school districts in fiscal year 2009, with a total cost of $43.8 million for fiscal year 2009 and $4.9 million in fiscal year 2010. This is the equivalent to a 1% increase in the formula, as I mentioned. The majority of this new investment, $20.5 million, paid through the bill's freezing of SUCOM revenue to school districts currently participating in the program or with applications pending as of March 20th. A 4% reduction to the Department of Education of $892,000 is in the bill as well. Article 3, dealing with higher education, it reduces the MINSKU budget by $6.1 million compared to $26.6 million proposed by the governor. So that's an area where there's a major difference. Reduces the U of M by $6.1 million compared to $27.2 million proposed by the governor. We put an M for the double-digit increase in tuition and fees last year, and we just cannot go back to the days when the state budget was balanced at the expense of students and their families. We reduced the higher education, we reduced the Office of Higher Education by $111,000, which matches the governor, and we cut $7 million from the governor's ACHIEVE program. Article 4, dealing with workforce development, majority of cuts to DEED match the governor's initiative. We transfer $14 million from the Workers' Comp Special Fund. In the past, the minority, when they were in control, transferred $265 million from the Workers' Compensation Special Fund
So this transfer is much more modest than the one at that time. We transfer $8 million from the Workforce Development Fund, which was recommended by the governor. And here as well, there's a 4% cut in the agency, which was not recommended by the governor in that case. Articles 5 and 6, Environmental and Natural Resources. We reduced the operating budgets for DNR and PCA by 4%. Other reductions similar to the governor's proposal. We increased permit fees for those individuals and corporations that are not paying the true cost of the permit. The three areas impacted are aquaculture permits to cut plants in their shorelines, and permits to pollute. Article 7, dealing with energy, transfer from the Telephone Assistance Plan Fund, $4 million. We transfer from the Insurance Fraud Prevention Account, $2 million. We transfer from the Real Estate Education Research Recovery Fund, $1.35 million. Transfer from the Consumer Education Account, $100,000. Transfer from the Auto Theft Prevention Account, $230,000. Workload adjustment for do not call enforcement, $270,000 in the base, and we increase staffing for unclaimed property division by $130,000 for fiscal year 2009.
Representative Earhart.
Representative, the overview that I had, I'm going through the bill article by article in the order that the articles appear. And per the chair's request, was just covering some of the highlights in each one of those articles.
Representative Carlson, I think Representative Earhart, no, I think he's wondering if you're looking at a spreadsheet or you're kind of paging through the summary, or do you just have
these
something?
These references are to the
summary
bill, but there is also the spreadsheet that you should all have
okay.
in the packet that you can follow along in that regard as well. And in the spreadsheet, we have each and every one of the points that that I've been covering. If you take a look at your spreadsheet, you can follow it that way as well.
I think
but I'm just kind of picking and choosing a few, and if that's not productive, I can stop it. I thought Representative Simpson wanted
yes,
to kind of get a general
Simpson.
Idea of what was in the bill.
Did you, Representative Simpson, Representative Carlson's asking, is this kind of the level of overview you want?
I think, Madam Chair, that that's appropriate at this time. I do think that my members, I would assume, would like to take a few minutes and, like I said, talk about this and try and digest it. But, you know, we're talking tax policy for the state of Minnesota, and it's 8 o'clock at night again, and boom, here we are. And we got to get this thing done because I'm not sure why, but it's got to be done tonight. So I think we need a few minutes at least to talk about it.
Well, Representative Carlson, you know what I could suggest is...
Whatever your will is.
If you want to... you kind of gave a broad overview, and I think that covered it. Representative Earhart, I'm looking at you to see if you think this makes sense, too, as well with Representative Simpson. What we're really about here, members, is... adding the tax provisions. So I don't know that we need to have any long discussion about all the other provisions.
Madam Chair, that was my original
right.
intent until
right.
the request was for an overview.
Right, and I think Representative Carlson was just trying to hear what you were saying. What I'm hearing Representative Simpson saying is he wants to review the tax amendment. Is that correct?
Correct.
Not the other provisions, because members, the whole... House File 1812 has been out publicly for the public and all members of both parties for the exact same amount of time. So there's nobody advantaged by how long this bill has been available for review. But this committee is not dealing with what all the other fiscal committees did. We all stood on those committees, and the various committees we sat on, we got to interact on that and put our 2 cents in on those provisions. We're actually on the tax piece. So that amendment is what I had passed out and we took public testimony on. So, Representative Carlson.
And Madam Chair, the reason that I asked if the division chairs might attend and the fiscal analysts would be to be available to answer questions relative to the fee increases that may be in their particular article and or any references to tax policy.
Correct. Representative Simpson, what do you think? Or other members of the minority.
Do you really want to know?
Would you like a recess, or will you all just go home? I mean, members.
Madam Chair, I think at this time it'd be appropriate to take a 15-minute recess, but we can at least talk about this a little bit and get a feel for where we're at.
And I'm fine with that, so I'll do that in a minute here. I want to be clear that, you know, this bill is the bill that's been moving through the process for a month, and so all of us who sit on fiscal committees, which I think pretty much everyone in this room does, has seen those provisions. If you sit on Representative Lukavina's committee, you've reviewed that. If you sit on, you know, Representative Markworth, if you sit on, you know, whatever committee you sit on, we're not doing those here today. Those fiscal chairs are here to defend their fee provisions or tax provisions, but we're actually adding the FOC to pay for it. So that amendment's been passed out. It's, I don't have it in front of me, but it's 10 pages or whatever.
Madam Chair.
And then we can reach us to talk about, you know, what to let the minority look at the FOC royalty and tax saving provisions. Representative Simpson.
Okay, thank you. I guess I will say at this point there are a numerous amount of fees and changes in this bill, and I'm not sure, but some of the people on my side of the aisle may want to make some amendments to take some of these out or make some adjustments to them. As I remember, maybe in years past, when the minority railed for hour on hour about fees and taxes and these increased bills, so I think it's only appropriate that we at least get a chance to look through it and make a decision before we move forward.
And that's fine, Representative Simpson. I would just add, you know, the only time I've watched this process play out is in, I think it was 02 and 05, which at that time the current minority had the similar process, which is to have a lot of finance articles put together. And these fees and tax items that are in the fiscal bills are not new. Again, they've been being worked on by those chairs and their majority-minority members for, you know, months. So I just don't want to leave the impression here that these are new provisions. They're not. In fact, some of you will recognize them from last year. And, in fact, we debated many of them last year, and then the governor vetoed them. So there's not that much new stuff in here. But if Representative Simpson and the minority think that they need some time, I think that's appropriate. And with that, we are in recess till 8 o'clock. Okay, members, we're back from recess, and Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. On behalf of the minority, thank you for indulging us a few moments to kind of go through this. I think some of our members have got some questions and some amendments, and with that, I believe if you want to do your amendment first, that's fine. Whatever you as chair decide to do, we'll go along with it. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, Representative Simpson, and thank you, members. Representative Carlson, are you ready for amendments? Or are you done?
Madam Chair, I was done before I was asked to walk through the bill. So, and I got about halfway through, and I think Representative Simpson said uncle at that point, and so I'm ready and have been for some time.
We appreciate your flexibility, Representative Carlson, with that. We have some amendments, I think. I think Representative Paulson?
Yep.
I do not have them. Are there amendments?
I think the pages have them, Madam Chair.
Okay. And I think Representative Dill has told me he has one. And Representative Rukavina, Representative Atkins. Does anybody want to offer an amendment? Anybody who feels as though they're ready?
What's playing?
Were you ready, Representative Paulson, or you want to?
I think so, man.
Okay, we'll go with whatever you've got for Representative Paulson.
Sure.
All
right.
Okay, so we're going to have Representative Paulson take a look at his amendment. Thank you. Okay, so if you could give him one.
Yep. Well, Madam Chair, maybe I can explain a little bit while they hand out.
Representative Paulson, yes.
Well, Madam Chair, this is, I believe, on the A-10 amendment that's being handed out, and I know that in your original amendment or tax bill that you had proposed, you had the provision that would have lowered the corporate income tax rate. This amendment is actually similar to the amendment I offered on the floor, so it does lower the corporate tax rate down 1%, but it also does so with the qualifying provisions that the corporations that are going to be receiving the lower rate be also accommodating and showing in provisions that they're actually producing jobs. And I know that's been some of the discussion that's gone on with Job Z as an example. ensuring that we're actually seeing results. And so there are some payroll requirements there, as you can see. So the average, I think, job that would be created about of these 500 jobs in order to receive the reduction would be about $25,000. And you know, I have to say, Madam Chair, that given the testimony we heard from the business leaders in the state, or certainly representatives of the business leadership in the state, is that I think we've heard that we're going to be sending a wrong message if we just pass this amendment onto this the Carlson bill here, and we're going to be potentially chasing jobs out of the state. I think we need to do this if we're going to give a glimmer of hope, if we're going to be able to show that we want to turn the tide a little bit and actually create some jobs here and maybe offset and balance some of the other provisions in the bill.
Okay, so Representative Paulson with the A10 Amendment. Discussion and amendment. Representative Colbert.
Madam Chair and members, in your bill, you had a balanced bill. You had, as you made it on the table, doing away with some of the corporate subsidies and then allowing the corporate tax rate to be benefit for everybody. In this particular case, I don't think that there's a fiscal or revenue estimate. I always want to say fiscal note, but revenue estimate, that this is a balanced number. There's going to be a cost on this, particularly in this biennium, and I would say that even though I don't have a number for it, obviously there is a big cost for this in this particular biennium. And it'd be very difficult, I think, to quantify the benefits in the next biennium. So I would think you have two choices. It would violate the resolution that you have before us, or vote it down.
So the discussion of the A10 Amendment. Is there anyone who would like to speak to the A10 Amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Oh. I'm sorry, I thought Representative Broad was going to speak.
Oh. Representative Broad. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
No. The amendment is not adopted. I will go ahead and move the my amendment then, the A081555, and everybody had that passed out ahead of time. That is the FOC royalty tax haven and security cap amendment that we took public testimony on. So if everyone's clear on that, discussion to the A081555 amendment. Representative Carlson?
Well, Madam Chair, this is an extremely important amendment and should be passed. It will put the bill in balance and bring all of the numbers together that were under the House budget resolution.
No, further discussion?
Madam Chair?
Representative Simpson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the only question I have on it is I find it interesting, and in this pile of somewhere, the dollar amount that seems to be keeps bouncing around, and I think we're using, is it 200 and some million now? I think I've seen, 201 million. I've seen numbers from 95 million, now we're at 130 million, now we're at 201 million. I think a question for maybe Representative Carlson or our other lead chair here is, how reliable is this number, and what do we do if this number isn't reality?
Thanks for that, Representative Simpson. And I think the confusion in the numbers may be related to different FOC bills in the past. The Senate has done it one way, the House has done it another. This is the same way that went through this committee last year and was voted on in this committee last year, I think, pretty much on a party line. The numbers have changed a little because FOC, although spoken about for many years, was not enacted. But additionally, because this has the foreign royalty subtraction, which the House Tax Committee passed last year as well. I see Dr. Wilson is here. Dr. Wilson, do you want to just answer Representative Simpson's question? For members, back when we heard the corporate subsidy bill, that was the revenue estimate. We took the numbers directly out of, and I have mine in my packet, and we can make it available again for people to look at. But Dr. Wilson, do you want to talk about Representative Simpson's concern about the numbers moving with FOC? Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Simpson. The number, two comments. One is that the numbers did change from the time the FOC bill was heard a week or more ago in this committee. And that change was due just simply to a short time to pull together the numbers. We did our best. We took some shortcuts, and these numbers are now the numbers we would have gotten to if we'd done it and done it more carefully at that time. So there is a change here. The numbers, it raises a little less than we said it raised at the last hearing, and those are just simply improved numbers, corrected numbers. I think the chair is right. The real difference here is the numbers are not bouncing around so much. The proposals are just different. Repealing the FOC and the royalty deduction is simply a lot more than simply saying it must be foreign active income. And if you say it must be foreign active income, but you allow the FOC and the royalty to continue, you don't make, you know, pick up as much money as if you just ban them completely or get rid of them completely. So this does have the added complexity, added wrinkle rather, of phasing in the royalties change, so it's a little different change the first year than the second, which again changes the numbers again somewhat. But the different numbers that have been out there, I think, are consistent with the differences in the proposals.
Thank you.
Simpson. Okay. Further questions? Representative Rod.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Wilson, I'm just wondering, do the numbers include or assume any change in business practices by these corporations?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Rod, the way the estimates are done generally, we have good data on foreign operating corporations. We know what foreign operating corporations and royalties were claimed in historic years. We have to base our estimate on the historic years. And we do look at some trends beyond that, but we don't specifically go in and say that behavior will change based upon that. Now, we do have, the historical trends are useful. There has been some downturn in the FOC in the last year, it looks like. But royalties have been up even more than the FOC, well, have been up. So to some extent, there's some balancing there. But we have not built in assumptions about changes in the data.
Thank you. We have a cell, Representative Broad, I think we have a cell phone problem again. Okay, Representative Broad.
It's not mine. But anyway, what I'm concerned about a little bit is that, you know, we hear often that, you know, businesses change their way of doing business, and if state laws are going to be changing along with it, it seems to me that to base increasing expenditures over time on a diminishing source of income and also on a very speculative source of income might be creating a sense of false income or false revenues and could put us in a situation of deficit down the road. And so I think we should be a little careful firming up expenditures based on false revenue sources that I just don't know how you can bank on. You can bank on these dollars coming in when business practices can and should change over time. And so it just seems to me that we're setting ourselves up for a significant structural problem down the road.
Thank you, Representative Broad. Further discussion to the 1555 amendment. Representative Lang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I really have to object to what's happening here tonight. We have on the agenda that you prepared public testimony on House File 4103, and what you've done is you've given us a whole new approach, a new amendment. We're not really dealing with 4103. You've taken parts of 4103, changed some parts, added some to it, and have put forward an amendment to balance this budget bill, so-called budget bill. In my 6 years on the tax committee, I don't ever recall things being handled like that. I'm disappointed with the way this is being handled right now. For you to give us a brand new amendment and expect to have us vote on that and act on it here tonight, when the agenda said we were going to have public testimony on the full bill that we had before us, I don't think is the way to go about running the tax committee.
Well, thank you for that, Representative Lanning. Maybe the confusion lies, and if you go look at the agenda, we've had Jobsy
auditor report on the agenda repeatedly, and the legislative auditor told us they couldn't make it the last couple times, so we've moved it down, and I insisted on hearing that testimony tonight before we acted. We heard Representative Leader's bill, which we had heard had to be passed quickly, so that's how that got here. But then the next item on the agenda, public testimony on House Bill 4103. That bill is not before us. Then the next bill is House Bill 1812, Representative Carlson's deficit reduction bill. And I think members know that in general, to do a deficit reduction bill, you have to have the revenue to do it, and that's what the tax committee was going to be addressing. Maybe the confusion, Representative Lanning, lies in that somewhere on that agenda you thought we would be doing the omnibus tax bill, which is not what we're doing tonight. And the omnibus tax bill, I think we will try to complete by the end of the month, and we're really just starting that process. So I would hope that members would give House File 4103 their full consideration for when we do the omnibus tax bill, because I'm a strong advocate of that bill, and I want people to really think long and hard about what it means when we continually do corporate subsidies and what that means for the cost of our budget. But that debate will take place for the omnibus tax bill. This is not the omnibus tax bill that we're doing right now. This is Representative Carlson's bill to respond to the deficit. So my amendment that includes FOC and royalty is the same provisions we passed in this committee last year, and we all voted on last year, and as I stated before, I assumed it'd be kind of a party line vote. It was the larger FOC with the royalty. We also had the securities cap in there. The one piece that's different is tax haven, and that's why I insisted that the business community have the opportunity to testify prior to voting, because they did not have an opportunity to testify on tax havens. But the FOC is still alive in this biennium. It was passed in this committee before, so I think the confusion might be that folks think we're doing the omnibus tax bill here tonight. And for the life of me, I think part of it is that the Senate has already done theirs, and I just don't know why they've already passed an omnibus tax bill. But we have the whole month of April to work on ours, and we will be beginning that process tomorrow. So.
Well, Madam Chair, the amendment that you put before us has some of the same elements as your omnibus tax bill. And you changed some of the things in it, you've added some things to it. But what's on the agenda is 4103. Your amendment was not on the agenda. The person who saw your amendment was the one that was handed out here tonight. And what further adds to my frustration is that 1812 has been billed all along as a deficit reduction bill, and as it turns out, 1812 is an omnibus bill. It has all kinds of policy provisions in it, and I've been trying over the weekend to get copies of it. Finally got a copy this afternoon to have a chance to look through it, since we're going to hear it tonight. And I know we're only dealing with the tax provisions, but this is an omnibus bill. It's much more than a deficit reduction bill, and so these things are being thrown at us without little opportunity to really consider them, give them due deliberation, and act on them. We're all supposed to do this immediately now and look at possible amendments and the rest. I just don't think this is the way to do this, and I'm very disappointed.
Okay, well, and we have Carlson, you have Forrest Broad. I think Representative Lanning, maybe the confusion lies in something I just heard you say. House File 4103 is not the omnibus tax bill either. So both House File 4103, the corporate subsidy bill, and House File 1812, Carlson, the deficit reduction bill, neither one of those is the omnibus tax bill. So I do think the press was kind of reporting on something implying 4103 was the omnibus tax bill in the House, but it's not, and we haven't even begun that process. So maybe folks were thinking that. I don't know where that came from, but it certainly didn't come from me. It was an idea to begin to address corporate subsidies. This committee, on both sides now, will have to decide if that's something they're going to want to do at the end of the month, but that's not what we're doing here tonight. So, you know, maybe Representative Carlson, he's next on the list, wants to address some of the other pieces as the policy or frustration with what's in the finance articles, but this committee is only addressing the tax provisions, and that would be the case no matter what bill was before us. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out a couple of three things. The bill, the component parts of it, some of it has been out there for almost 2 weeks in the various divisions. It was acted upon last Thursday in its entirety in the Finance Committee, so it's been out there in its total component parts, if you will, because each of these are division reports since Thursday. But I do want to emphasize that every one of the divisions had meetings with their article much earlier than that. So it's been out there, and I've had meetings with the lead on the Finance Committee, and he was present at the meetings when this bill was put together, so there's been general knowledge. As far as the tax part of it, if you look at the Ways and Means Committee action in terms of setting the targets, all of us should have known what the target was for this committee. And speaking of the target, I just wanted to point out with the spreadsheet that you have, if you take a look at the House column, it's 795.8 million, and that would be without any action by the Tax Committee. If you add the 201 million that's in the amendment, that brings us to 997. And the reason we need to be at 997 is that the deficit is 935 million. We have to build in roughly 40 million for the bridge. There's been about 3 million in other bills, and 18 million is built into it for the capital investment bill. And that leaves us, I think, about 1.7 million, if I recall, from my conversations with Representative Mark, or Mr. Mark. I keep trying to
roll
here, yeah.
Representative Carlson, we all want to make the top
right.
staff around here legislator.
But Madam Chair, then that would bring us to 997 million, and if your amendment goes on, that brings us to 997 million. That's what I meant earlier, that we were right on target. But I do want to underscore for the members of the public and the members of the committee that there isn't anything in this bill 1812 that hasn't been out there for some time.
Okay, Representative De La Forest.
Madam Chair, thank you, and I share some of the frustrations of Representative Lanning in that, you know, I understand that this bill is here and other bills come before us now because it's our jurisdiction to take a look at fees, for example. And this bill has fees throughout its 372 pages with the addition of your amendment. And what's troubling to me is having a lack of opportunity to read the bill in its entirety. And obviously I don't sit on every finance committee. For example, Representative Carlson, you have a provision in here that abolishes the cap on the harvest of aquatic plants. I think, for example, that's something the taxes committee ought to investigate more thoroughly. In my cursory reading of the bill, I also see that there's a $1.35 million raid of the real estate recovery fund, which, as I understand, and I don't know this, but I'd like to ask, I believe it's funded by the fees that realtors pay when they renew their license. And it's also a fund, as I understand it, that is used for recovery. For example, if a real estate agent engages in unethical practices and defrauds one of their clients, they can recover out of that fee. And this is an example of some of the implications of the fees and the way that fees are being manipulated for purposes to balance the budget. And that's my frustration, is that I haven't had an opportunity to look through the bill.
Representative LaForest, that's, I agree. And I did share the list of all the tax items and fees as soon as I got it, about an hour after I got it, with Representative Simpson, and I am having it copied now so all members can see that. But you're right, there are. That's what we're here for, is those fee items that are in different fiscal bills and tax items. And so we're going to get that passed around real quick. I know that you could probably walk us through the Representative De La Forest division that you presented with Representative Kahn and explained all the divisions people shouldn't vote for, as I heard you in finance. But you know that article very well, and I understand what you're saying. You don't know the others. And so we're going to have it's being copied now, and everybody will be able to see what are the fees and tax provisions in there.
And Madam Chair, I certainly appreciate that, and I have faith in the documents that you pass out, but it's still frustrating to me in that perhaps I'm old-fashioned or in the minority around here. I do like to at least take a cursory look myself through the bill. Because, for example, you're not increasing fees with respect to the Real Estate Recovery Fund, but it's an important provision to me in that funds are being tapped from it. And so I don't know if it would show up on a sheet, for example, that says these are the fee increases. But nonetheless, it is a fee, as I understand it, that's paid by realtors that I think has broader implications for all of us. I imagine we certainly have realtors and people who buy real estate, buy a house, and sell a house within our district. And that's just an example of where I get frustrated in not having the ability to look through the bill myself.
Okay, thank you for that. Representative Broad.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just had I wanted to go back to those FOC numbers because as I was looking through my folder, I found the revenue estimate from the 2007 bill dated April 10, 2007. And I just happened to come across it. And I'm curious from Mr. Wilson. Representative Winteski said that this FOC provision is a broader provision or, oops, I'm sorry, Mr. Wilson. Sorry, Mr. Wilson.
Dr. Wilson.
Oh, Dr. Wilson, I'm sorry. I thought you were still sitting there. I should look before I speak. I apologize. Representative Winteski spoke, he said that last year's provision was a larger FOC provision, and the only difference, the way I heard it, was that there was now a tax haven provision. Is that your understanding, or how do the two compare?
Dr. Wilson.
I'm not sure, Representative Rod. Last year's omnibus bill in the House, of course, had worldwide apportionment. It's a completely different idea than is in this bill. But this bill is a broader proposal, I believe, than was in bills heard last year.
Representative Brown, maybe I can shed some light on this confusion, and I asked Mr. Michael to address the difference. When I was saying it was bigger than the Senate. The Senate was doing, which they're still doing, a different FOC proposal than the House has been doing, and I think the governor is doing a different one still. So, Mr. Michael, can you address the differences between last year and this year in the House tax bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, the commonality between the 2007 and the 2008 provisions is that they both repealed the FOC regime and the foreign royalty regime. The difference is that the 2008 version has this tax haven addition, and the 2007 gave corporations a limited option of opting for worldwide unitary apportionment, which in some instances for businesses that have lower relative levels of income to their factors in their foreign operations could have been advantageous to them. And so therefore I believe that the revenue estimate, I'm sure that the revenue estimate that was done assigned a cost to that feature of the bill. That is not a feature of this proposal, and so therefore there's no offset for the fact that when the research division at Revenue did the estimate last year, they assumed that a few businesses would opt for worldwide unitary because it would reduce their tax, even though it was over a long period of time, and generally the conventional wisdom is worldwide unitary increases taxes.
Okay, Representative Demmer. Oh, Representative Broad.
Well, Madam Chair, the reason I was asking is that I'm still very concerned about the fluctuating nature of these revenue estimates and the fact that this bill will bank funding on things that I'm just not sure are going to be there. I think it's a little phantom. But last year's revenue estimate, just for reference, was $173 million, and in 2010-2011, it dropped down significantly to $119 and $116 million. And, you know, the tax haven provision is only $4.5 million. I find it hard to believe that this option would be worth a significant difference. And so I just wanted to, since I found this, I just thought it was rather interesting that the numbers have bumped up rather relatively heavily this year. And then, Madam Chair, I had a question on an unrelated provision in the bill. I'm just wondering about the goals of the bill, because as I look through the provisions, in especially the state government finance portions of the bill and a number of other portions of the bill, many of these provisions were actually noted in veto messages by the governor as those bills came out of the House. you're absolutely right that those provisions, especially the state government finance provisions, have been sitting out there because members on your side of the aisle and members on our side of the aisle absolutely opposed a strong opposition to that part of the bill. And it got vetoed very early, and so it has been sitting out there because there's such significant opposition. Now those opposed items are a part of this bill, and so I'm wondering, Representative Carlson, what your actual final goal for this bill is, because it includes a significant number of things that have already faced the veto pen.
Representative Carlson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I wouldn't be sitting here if my ultimate goal wasn't to have the bill ultimately make it into law. Now, it has a long way to go. Has to go later this week to Ways and Means. Thursday it'll be up on the House floor, and then there's a conference committee. And I assume at various points, probably mainly in the conference committee, the governor may very well weigh in with some additional concepts or ideas from the executive's perspective, and then you'll have to make a judgment on the final product when it comes out of conference committee, as will the governor.
Okay, Representative Demmer, and then Representative Paulson. Representative Demmer.
Well, Madam Chair, I have to register my disappointment also, and quite frankly, surprise. I sit on the Education Finance Committee as well as K-12 Division, which means I got a chance to see the K-12 and the Higher Education and Jobs article, Madam Chair. But I didn't get a chance to see, well, first of all, on the ones that I saw, Madam Chair, and then I'm Representative Carlson, maybe you're the one to ask about this, or maybe we need to get Representative Rukavina and Representative Greiling involved. Are these the exact, this is a new bill. This is a new bill that has language that you're telling us is language we've seen before. Are we to be guaranteed that this is exactly the same bill that passed out of those committees, and that the language is identical and there's been no changes to them? I mean, that would be a question I would have, and then I'll follow that up by saying, let's expand that into the agricultural, the transportation, the state government, the other places that have these things in here, they're in this bill, are they all identical to what came out of those divisions? And the other question I would have, and there's a series of them here, and I can ask them one at a time if you want to wait for questions, or I'll just put them all out there. Are we not going to see these individually in the House floor to be able to vet them out? And am I supposed to assume that in, what, the 1 hour that I've seen all of these bills, this is my opportunity to have some committee time with them? Yes, they may have been seen in committee someplace. I haven't seen them. And am I just supposed to trust that, well, because, and Madam Chair, your answer was, well, the Democrats haven't seen them either. Is that good lawmaking? Is that good process, Madam Chair, to say that, well, nobody's seen it, so don't worry about it?
Representative Demmer, I don't think that's what I said. If you don't sit on taxes tonight, you still don't see them. I think we all know how the process works. We have a lot of committees, and if you sit on committees and bills come through, you see them. All of us vote on hundreds of bills every year on the floor that we've never seen in a committee. So we're all fortunate that we have to sit on taxes, that we get to see all these tonight. But if you don't sit on taxes, half the members won't see this before it comes to the floor. You have to be... You will have seen K-12 if you sit on Representative Greiling's committee. You will have seen housing if you sit on Representative Clark's committee. I mean, there's no rule in the House of Representatives that every member reviews every bill before it comes to the floor for passage. So we're sort of uniquely situated and fortunate as tax committee members that we actually get to see this stuff, but most members do not. And that has been the same the entire 10 years I've been here. Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that, Madam Chair, and I agree with you. But this is an omnibus bill, and we received it, Representative Lanning said he got it this afternoon, the rest of us saw it just tonight. And yes, we're in tax meeting, we get a chance to see it, we didn't have any advance, we didn't get a day or two to look at this and be prepared, Madam Chair, and I think whenever we see bills in it, whatever committee we go to, we get a chance to prepare and look at these bills. And this is a 360-page bill that we didn't have to get a chance to prepare for as a whole bill.
Representative Demmer, if Representative Carlson can have an opportunity to respond, the point of these bills coming here is not for us to get to review all the provisions and all the fiscal bills. It's because Representative Krenke and Senator Poldenor passed the fee versus tax bill that requires them to come here. Prior to last year, they never came here, and no one who sat on taxes even saw them.
The tax parts is what what members would have seen, and that's what we're adding now.
Yep.
What I would tell you, I was the conferee, the minority conferee, when Representative Knobloch did the identical thing. And I didn't see it either, and those bills didn't travel through all those committees either. So the reason the tax committee sees it is not to review all these fiscal divisions, fiscal bills. I mean, I know when I'm voting on the House floor on the omnibus state self finance bill, I've never seen it before. I don't sit on that committee. So I think there's a sense of maybe injustice here that is a little unwarranted, because that is not normally the process and has not been. But I first want to give Representative Carlson a chance to respond to Representative Demmer, then we'll go back to Representative Demmer.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer asked essentially if there could be a guarantee that these bills are identical to the way they came out of the various divisions. There were some amendments that were added in the full Finance Committee, and you referenced K-12 specifically. One of them was a housekeeping amendment that dealt with physical education requirements. The other one in the area of K-12, I think, was one offered by Representative Mariani. But Representative Greiling is here, and she could comment on that. But the purpose of the bill being here, going back to the chair's comments, is to take a look and discuss that, or the various tax and fee items that appear in the bill. Two issues that I referenced that maybe were different from the Finance Committee report versus what came out of Representative Mary Murphy's division are items that don't impact on either tax or fees.
Okay. Representative Fulber, were you for that point? Okay, back to Representative Demmer, then Paulson.
Well, Madam Chair, and I understand what you're saying about us having to deal with the fees. I understand we can't revet every single thing that comes to every single bill. But, Madam Chair, normally the K-12 bill would come through, we'd deal with it with its fees, and we'd pass it on through. And the transportation bill would come, we deal with the fees, and we'd pass it on through. This is a 360-page omnibus bill that is not something I can look up on my computer and say, oh, this is the K-12 bill, and I can see what happened to it in K-12, or I can see what happened to it in finance. It's now in a brand new bill, Madam Chair, as an article. And there's no way for me to know that the bill that we passed out of K-12 finance, or that passed out of education finance, is the same, that article is the same bill that passed through. There's no way for me to know that. And as you know, what's happened at various times in legislation is a bill comes through, and unless we notice it, there are small changes. One line or one word can make a huge change, Madam Chair. This is not the bill that passed through. This article may be the same language, and that's what I asked for. It may be guaranteed, but it's not the same bill. Unless you're guaranteeing me that that article is House file such and such, in which case we can say, okay, that passed through K-12. We know what's in there. But this is a brand new bill, Madam Chair, with new language that could be different from the bills that were passed through on those divisions. That's my point. As you said, if this was a bill that had passed through each of those divisions and was dealing with fees, that'd be one thing. But it's not. This bill, as it is, as a whole, has not. It's got pieces that have. And there's no way to know if each of those pieces are identical to what came out of those divisions. Because it's not the bill that I can go back and look at my computer and say, here's how it passed out.
And Representative Cameron, you know every committee has the right to change a bill, and it changes form as it moves through committee. So there's never any guarantee that anything stays the same. And I think this bill still has to go to Ways and Means and then to the floor, which I'm sure there'll be amendments there as well. To that point, Representative Fulber.
Madam Chair, I'm not going to prolong this kind of debate, but there's a very large bill without any question. And 2 years ago, there was a very large bill also that was put together by the other side of the party. And the same type of thing with lots of budget reductions and expenditures in it. But you know, all of us have staff. And for anybody to say that I haven't had a chance to read the bill, I challenge anybody to have read any bill in the House, in the tax bill that's come through, to read every page. But our staff is well informed of it, and they inform us of all the different processes that are in there. And this was passed out of the Finance Committee last Thursday. Gives plenty of opportunity to know what's in this bill and know what provisions are that maybe that you want to have amendments for.
Okay, Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just back to the amendment, the 1555 amendment. I'm just going to speak about some concerns I have about the amendment. I mean, we heard testimony again here tonight, and I'll call this amendment risky. I think it is very risky. You know, here we are. They said we're either number four, we will be number four. No other state is going in this direction with this type of repeal of these type of provisions on the FOC provisions, if you want to call it that. And I just think it is a very risky scheme that it's going to set us ourselves up for jeopardy unless we are able to put on some job incentives and some other amendments. And that doesn't even get into the mutual fund amendment that's still on a part of this. And I'm sure Representative Earhart will talk about it again. But I think it's an injustice to have that provision here. So I'm going to oppose this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Paulson. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
No.
The amendment is adopted. Further amendments? I think we've got...
Madam Chair, 1562.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the 1562 amendment. It's the A08-1562, and it's technical in nature. If you look
Representative Dill, it's still being passed out, or it's just starting to be passed out. Okay. 1562, members.
Is it out?
Thank you. Have it now.
Oh, okay. This amendment begins on page 188. It has to do with an administrative fee that is going to be temporary until the DNR establishes a fee schedule to recoup fees relative to a permit to mine for each one of the mines or mines that are in the future that haven't opened yet. And when you read the amendment starting on page 188, if you read the bill, 188.29, it says the owner, operator, and manager of the following mine shall pay $90,000. And then it says MNTAC and KETAC. It's supposed to be that's one owner paying $90,000. So the amendment, which is the 1562 amendment, is merely a clarification that we're trying to raise $200,000 here, not about $450,000 the way it's drafted originally. So it's really a technical amendment. I talked to Representative Lagunias, Chair Lagunias. She is in agreement that we're trying to raise $200,000, not $450,000, and so that's the genesis of the amendment.
Thank you. Representative Lagunias.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, it cost the DNR $200,000. It's their estimate to run this program. We are only want to recoup the exact amount it costs the department.
Okay. Thank you for that. Questions for either for Representative Dill or Representative Lagunias? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted.
No.
Further amendments? Do you have any? I think Representative Paulson has some. I don't know which one you'd like us to take, Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the A-12 amendment.
Representative Paulson, I don't have it.
I would move that amendment.
Okay. Go to the A-12.
And members, this amendment is simply the single sales apportionment, accelerating that up. Again, if we're going to go in the wrong direction, I think, in terms of some of the implications of the tax policy, this is tax policy for corporations here in the state of Minnesota. As we heard, we have 20 Fortune 100 companies in the state, and I think the single sales fact, which has been worked on a very bipartisan basis, as you had mentioned, is an opportunity to send a signal that at least we're going to counter some of those effects. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer that amendment on the single sales factor, which has been supported bipartisanly, and ask for a roll call.
Okay, so Representative Paulson moved the A-12 amendment and asked for a roll call. Discussion to the amendment. Representative Paulson, I'll let Representative Carlson address the amendment as well. You know, I'll urge people to vote no. I do want to say that I completely agree with Representative Paulson's initiative here from a policy perspective. This knocks the budget, the budget balancing bill out of balance, but Representative Paulson is right. This has been a bipartisan initiative for quite a while, and I know it's important to the governor as well. And Representative Paulson had an amendment on the floor this year on the federal conformity bill, and it's something I remain committed to. I don't know how it's all going to play out in the times of not having money, but this committee has tried to move in this direction bipartisanly for a long time, but I would urge folks to oppose the amendment as the resources are not available to implement it at this time. Representative Carlson?
Madam Chair, I don't have much to add other than to
echo what you just indicated, and this is a delicately balanced bill, and it would put the bill out of balance. So I would urge a no vote.
Okay. Further questions or comments for Representative Paulson's amendment? If not, the clerk will take the roll.
One question?
No.
If you have a bit, no.
Braun?
Yes.
Carlson?
No.
Stabney?
No.
De La Forest?
Yes.
Summer?
Yes.
Still?
No.
Earhart?
Yes.
Pilstrom? Yarrow?
No.
Coonan?
No.
Cole? Lanning?
Yes.
Lutch?
No.
Liebling?
No.
Marquardt?
No.
Mullery?
Yes.
Paulson?
Yep.
Rukavina?
No.
Simpson?
Yes.
Silver?
No.
Powell?
No.
Silberry?
No.
Wolfbarger?
No.
Zeller?
Aye.
Pilstrom? Cole?
And a vote of 8 ayes and 16 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Thank you. Further amendments, and we have one labeled Rukavina, but we understand it's Representative Sorber. So, Representative Sorber, did you want to offer an amendment?
I don't know if we have it in written form, do we?
Yes.
Yes, we do. Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Solberg, but it might say Rukavina.
Yeah.
That's trouble. You two are in on this together.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, it's the A14 amendment. It's a very technical amendment. If I can move the amendment. And it's on page 153. There's both the county of Aiken and the city of Aiken. And it just says Aiken. So this clarifies that it's to the city of Aiken, not just the Aiken city.
Okay.
It's very technical.
Representative Carlson.
I think that one sounds okay, Madam Chair.
Okay. Further discussion of the A14.
So we're not enrolled in
I would hope not, because I would be voting against at least one of my
enemies. Further discussion. I don't know if someone said something. I couldn't hear. People were laughing so hard. So was there really a request? No. Okay. To the A14 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Further amendment. Representative Paulson, you have more?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think I'll just offer one more amendment to A11 amendment. That's been handled. But, Madam Chair, please, if you can just, again, give us one crumb here. This would be this is actually an amendment that would increase. I know you don't like tax credits, Representative Romanchewski, but this would increase the R&D tax credit to 5%, and it would just be a flat 5%. And I do that because we have heard also in this committee numerous amount of testimony supporting the biotech industry, the medtech industry. I know Representative Dabney's had proposals on this effort. We heard some of the higher percentages of these research development tax provisions that are offered throughout the country. And Minnesota's an island on the low end right now, and so this just goes up to a flat 5% and would ask we can get something to the other side here, this amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Paulson moves A11. And Representative Paulson, I appreciate, I said to someone on your side, I don't remember who it was, it might have been Craig Stone, that Representative Paulson always has the best tax committee amendments, that if people would really track them, they'd realize how hard they are to vote against. And this is another one, Representative Paulson, but I urge people to vote no. I do want to say, though, that Representative Paulson, I hope that you will work with Representative Dabney and Representative Mahoney. And I heard the testimony of Mr. Hesse very clearly as the interaction between royalties and R&D. And I think we need to work on this more. I'm not convinced what we're having is working, but you're trying to compete with the other states. I appreciate that. This would knock the number we have out of balance. So I'd encourage people to vote no. But I do think that R&D credits, with you, with the governor, with Representative Dabney, with Representative Mahoney, a number of people are becoming more and more important to this committee, Representative Winkler, and I think we need to have a discussion on that. So I'd urge people to vote no, but want to keep working with you, Representative Paulson. Representative Brott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know, Madam Chair, if it's helpful or not, but there is, on the bottom line, for the House and the Senate, there is $4 million each in unspent dollars. And rather than spending them on the House and the Senate administration and activities, it seems like we ought to spend them, and just a suggestion, we could spend them in this direction in trying to do what I think we all believe is necessary. I mean, innovation and entrepreneurialism are absolutely part of the fabric of what makes us Minnesotans. And so I think with the R&D tax credit, we could certainly find money to do this. And I hope that if it's not today, that we work very hard in coming up with those dollars, because this will actually increase revenues coming in if we can keep businesses innovating and investing. And I hope that we can do that. Hopefully tonight, Madam Chair, if not tonight, along the way.
Madam Chair, I think that this is, as I read it, an open-ended, not just limited to $4 million additional cost. As I read it, there's no, you take any of the caps off. I don't have a revenue estimate on this one, but I'm sure it's just much more than that.
Further discussion of 811. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Further amendments?
Yes.
Are there any further amendments? Representative Braun.
Madam Chair, I just had a question. I'm just wondering if somebody can fill me on the spreadsheet where I would find the funds to litigate this bill that does not pass the constitutional test.
Representative Broad. You know, Representative Broad, I think we should ask, if it's all right with the author, just Mr. Michael to give us a little history on these kinds of questions. Yes, Representative Colbert. Sure, Representative Colbert.
In the same place that we found the funds for 2 years ago, when the Republicans were in charge.
Representative Brock.
Madam Chair, I just want the record to show that I think Representative Lesch just offered his services pro bono.
Representative Lesch?
I'm sorry, I haven't been paying attention.
Okay. Representative Zellers?
And you get what you
pay
for.
Okay. Further amendments. Are there any further amendments to House File 1812?
For Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Whiting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we should set the record straight about what happened 2 years ago, Knobloch. His budget bill was an omnibus kind of budget bill, but it didn't have all kinds of policy stuff like we have here today. It was a very different kind of bill. And I know the same question was raised even by one of our own members about the constitutionality of that. But it seems to me that this bill that we have before us just has way too much in it to meet the constitutional test.
Thank you for that, Representative Lanning. Further questions or comments? If not, I'll call Representative Carlson, Representative Zellers.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't know we were to the final here. One of the things that and we're still on the provision that we're supposed to be discussing, which is the amendment to 1811, the fees are what we heard. I think that's where the Fulgham Miller Krenke language came from, which is a tax is a tax or a fee is a fee. And I'm only to page 33, 34 here, but looking through just a quick summary here, we're adding fees or we're taking from funds. And you know, as Representative DeLaForest and Demard pointed out, we may not be adding a fee or a tax, but it's where you're stealing it from or taking it from that may have implications down the road. As we've heard in this committee many, many, many times, if we don't fund it here, provide for it here, it's going to be raised on the local property tax owners. And I think Representative Marquardt has gone above and beyond the call of duty on pointing out on some numerous occasions that this happens on the local level. And you know, just looking through this quickly, there was we're taking money from methamphetamine lab cleanup, a job skills partnership.
Those are both the governor's proposals.
That doesn't make it right. There are a number of different fees. We're reducing the mitigation for the Red River for dikes in different counties. We're Also, on top of that, Representative De La Forest pointed out the lakefront issue when it comes to assessing a fee for that, for aquatic plant management. So I guess you could say if we're taking money out of DNR on one side, we'll make it up on the fee schedule on the other side. We're going to add a ferrous minerals fee, which for some of our friends on the iron range, we heard this in the Commerce Committee, we're actually seeing a new development of business on the iron range and some metals that previously, because of drilling depths, we couldn't get to, but we're now actually seeing, and we're going to tax some of these. I don't know if they fall into that because we're, again, getting us in the 11th hour. But, Madam Chair and members, you know, there's a development for a bioenergy project up in the Elk River Economic Development Authority. There's $200,000 gone. So, you know, Madam Chair and members, we may not have a direct link. We're not increasing a tax or a fee. But what we're doing away with is going to have a trickle-down or a ripple effect on the people who are, you know, taking this money from. And I'm with Representative Lanning. I'm a little disappointed in the process. I'm very disappointed in the way we've come to this conclusion. Even if it's been out there, it doesn't matter if language has been scattered around. It's how you cobble it together or, in this case, smash it into the sandwich. And it may taste okay individually, but you get it together and it's going to taste horrible. And I just think we're going to set ourselves up for another veto, because half the language in here may have been out there, but it's been vetoed before. And the tax versus the fee argument that I think Representative Rukavina and a lot of members used against our governor is going to be revisited on your house tenfold. And I'm a little disappointed that we're going through this exercise for an end that I think everybody knows is going to happen. It's going to get vetoed.
Further discussion? Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, just a very quick comment. First of all, I want to thank the members of the committee and also the division chairs and staff from the finance side that were here tonight to answer any potential questions that came up. But just a quick reminder, members, the economy nationally has slowed. It has slowed in Minnesota. And this bill is before us because we have a $935 million problem. And no one ever said that it was going to be easy to resolve these issues. And we've had a series of tough choices. The product that is before you is the result of each and every one of those divisions that are attached to the Finance Committee and reflects their recommendations on how to resolve the issue. And I would appreciate the support of the committee. Thank you.
Okay, for the discussion, Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment on Representative Carlson's comments, and I understand what he's saying, but I also think when we look at the big picture and we look at the state of Minnesota and we look at the fact that sales tax revenues are down, corporate taxes are revenues are down, personal income tax revenues are down, I think this committee has to be very careful what kind of message we're sending the state, what kind of message we're sending our business community and our individual taxpayers. I think we need revenue perhaps, but maybe we need to be looking real seriously at how we're spending that revenue. And I don't think we're being very truthful in doing that. I think we're just looking at ways to raise dollars. And I think that as we move forward, this next biennium, this year is going to be a cakewalk. I think the next biennium is going to be tough, and there's going to be tough decisions made. And that's why I'm very fearful of what this committee does, what we say, and what kind of a message we put out to the business community and the residents of Minnesota.
Thank you. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor of Representative Carlson's motion to approve House File 1812, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
The bill is passed, and Representative Carlson is off to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Ways and Means.
That was part of
Thank you, members. Thank you. We are adjourned.